Hey, Project Big Screen listeners, you can find us every Monday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
Stella Blue Coffee is more than just great coffee. It's coffee with a purpose. Introducing We Brew to Rescue, a nationwide campaign using proceeds from our new ready-to-drink cans to help fund 1,000 pet adoptions this year. Every can you crack open helps a real pet find a real home. Simple as that. Made with 100% Colombian coffee, each 11-ounce can delivers smooth, drinkable energy with a boost of protein. Available in espresso cafe mocha and espresso sweet cream. Built for mornings, long days, and everything in between. Drink Stella Blue, fuel your day, and help save a pet's life. You can follow our progress in real time throughout the campaign by watching the adoption tracker on our site. Grab yours now at StellaBlueCoffee.com. Amazon and select retailers nationwide.
What happens when you lock 18 coworkers in an office for 1 week to compete for $250,000 of cash? This is Surviving Barstool Season 5, presented by Rumble Premium. Each episode released 3 hours early, so get it ad-free before anyone else, only when you join Rumble Premium. Surviving Barstool premieres Sunday, August 9th at 5 p.m. on Rumble Premium and everywhere else at 8 p.m.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
What killed the dinosaurs?
You want to come and jaw with you?
I'm going to make you famous, Lizzie.
It's not Al anymore. It's Dunk.
Dunkachino?
Don't mind if I do.
I'm the Joker, baby.
Welcome to Lights, Camera, Barstool, episode 14 of season 2. Jeff Lowe, Ken Jack, alongside once again our guest, Chris Castellani. We got a lineup of some Oscar contenders, I think is the best way to put it today. We're going to mostly focus on Power of the Dog, which is on Netflix. Many consider to be the front runner for Best Picture, which we will get into. I don't know. I'd be curious if any of us would consider it to be the best picture of the year. And then we will talk about two other movies as well, Belfast and Spencer, which are both Oscar nominees for different reasons, though. So we'll talk about both of those in our reviews. And we have an interview with Will Forte, MacGruber himself, the one and only MacGruber, which I
write. It was a really good story, by the way. It was, I got thinking exclusive from Will Forte.
It was a pretty funny SNL story. Yeah, but and then I ended up, because of it, I rewatched MacGruber the other night.
Very funny.
Still just a very funny, just in so many stupid ways, a very funny movie. So we'll get to all that. We got some news. We were supposed to get we're actually recording on a Monday because we crossed wires on our scheduling for recording the pod. But I was like, you know what? Not bad. We're going to get a new Matrix trailer. But it never dropped. The trailer never came out. So
we got the Daredevil thing. That's basically the only new bit of news we got.
Yeah. So we'll get the news here in a second. Before we get into that, this episode of Lights, Camera, Barstool, folks, is brought to you by Bare Bottom Clothing. This episode brought to you by Bare Bottom Clothing. Bare Bottom folks on a mission to make you more comfortable. Made to last menswear. Also, they give back to the community. Nothing better than that. It's comfy season too. You got to have your closet with comfortable pants, shirts. You're hanging around the house all the time. You don't want those crappy big box or online brands. You can feel good wearing your Bare Bottom clothes too, because a nutritious school meal donated every time you buy something to a child in need. All built for value and quality. You're getting soft, stretchy clothes that aren't. It's not going to wear out. You know, it's not a one-off winter for these clothes that you're going to get from Bare Bottom. And right now, for a limited time, Bare Bottom is giving you an incredibly soft tech tee or natural dye tee for free. You spend $150. That's right. They have fantastic clothing, very comfortable. It's that time of year. You want to be comfortable in the cold. 10% off your first order as well by going to Bear Bottom, B-E-A-R, bottomclothing.com/lights. That's bear like the animal, bottomclothing.com/lights. All right, let's get into, before we get to that, we got to congratulate Chris again. Chris, usually football teams on this podcast are garbage, but Michigan made the playoff, won the Big Ten, and the Lions got their first win. This is like reverse. It's not supposed to work like that with this show. Your teams are supposed to stink.
Man, I'll tell you what, this weekend, I mean, for me personally, it's the best weekend I've ever had, ever. It was amazing. Indianapolis was incredible. But from a state of Michigan standpoint, you had Michigan winning the Big Ten in football, Michigan basketball won, Lions won on the last play, Michigan State basketball won, and the entire state of Michigan won because the Detroit Pistons didn't play, I don't believe.
Yeah, so there you go.
That's a victory in and of itself. So
Central Michigan made the Barstool Sports Arizona.
Yes, I know. So we got definitely a lot going on, but I'm really, I'll say this forever. I'm really just happy for Jim Harbaugh and Michigan's program. Like those guys who came back and fought Aiden Hutchinson. Like I will be critical of my teams, but when they do something that makes me almost like just deliriously happy, I'm going to love every one of those guys forever. So it was really an incredible moment for the fan base, for the program.
And this morning there's a viral video going around in relation to Jared Goff's game winning touchdown pass from the Sports Illustrated account of Kristen Harper, who is an SI, or just a model doing like an SI swimsuit cover when it happened, and the amount of horny NFL writers quote tweeting the video, and they're like, "Oh, this is great. Love this for Jared Goff." It's like, what are you saying here? It's like all of them. It's like Ian Rapoport's like, "Wow, this is fantastic."
It's like, what do you call it? What was the Alabama, or was it Auburn guy who had a girlfriend?
It was Alabama. AJ McCarron's girlfriend. Yeah.
Yeah. AJ McCarron's girlfriend.
Brett Musburger. It sounded like he was about to chuck a bottle of Viagra at him.
Yeah. Musburger was going nuts for her. That Webb or something, right? Oh, he was going nuts.
Mm-hmm. Catherine Webb, I thought. Maybe that was it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Catherine Webb. Yeah. The replies to Ian Rapoport's tweet, he just goes, "This is the best." And it's just a very genuine video. It's not like the craziest thing I've ever. This is, you know, it's not like, like when soldiers are reunited with their kids at halftime. You know, it's like not like one of those.
It's way better than that, actually.
The reactions to Ian Rapoport's tweet, and he's one of many. Actually our own coworker, Will Compton of the Bustin' with the Boys podcast. He replied, he said, "I'm here for the comments."
Yeah.
Oh my God. All right. Well, congrats to the state of Michigan. Well done. Chargers won, Browns didn't play. So that was a no defeats this weekend.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Let's get into news. A lot of Spider-Man news. First off, being first trailer for Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, or excuse me, Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse Part 1. So it's a part 1 of 2, which is interesting because I feel like we did away with parts, and then because they even did that for Avengers. Like Avengers Infinity War was part 1 and then Avengers Infinity War Part 2. Then they renamed it. And which made sense because they really were completely different movies. One was a Thanos movie, another was an Avengers movie.
Yeah.
But we just saw this with Dune for obvious reasons. I was kind of surprised that it's just a weird thing that you wouldn't expect a part one, part two, especially with what is a wholly original story. However, that's not really a knock on the movie. I was just kind of caught off guard by that. Oscar Isaac, the big addition to the cast. He was in the post-credit scene, the very funny post-credit scene for the first Into the Spider-Verse, where you saw the Spider-Man 67, like the pointing meme, and it was one of the best scenes of the movie, and what is probably one of the best animated movies of all time, maybe one of the best comic movies of all time, depending on who you ask. But Oscar Isaac is in it as Spider-Man 2099, Miguel O'Hara, just another alternate version of Spider-Man. A lot of the cast is back. I think almost the entire cast is back. Apparently, we're getting Japanese Spider-Man from the 1978 Spider-Man series. That's going to be in the movie as well. This is less of a trailer and more of a... Apparently, this is the opening scene of the movie where you have Spider-Woman, Gwen Stacy, pop out of another dimension and say hello to Miles Morales. And then they kind of go down through the multiverse and you see Oscar Isaac's Spider-Man 2099 fighting with Miles Morales. And that's kind of how the trailer ends. So it's more of a first look, which is what they called it. But it comes out in October. So it makes sense that there's not a full trailer yet. But I mean, it's kind of impossible to not be excited for this movie. I will say expectations are going to be stupid high is my guess.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's kind of strange having a two-parter, especially in the middle of what would I assume would have been a trilogy or at least a multi-movie franchise. Like to have that, I expect that to be the third. Like, you maybe your third movie is a two-parter, and
I think there could be like a could it be like a almost like a referential thing though.
Maybe I don't know.
Could be part of that, knowing Lord and Miller, right?
Yeah, exactly. That was going to be my next point. Was just that, like, with Lord and Miller, that could be, they're so smart that, like, anything could really be up for grabs. And I'm happy that they are getting this is basically just confirmation that they are getting a third movie, which is even better because they are so smart. And I think what they did with Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse is just absolutely brilliant. I do think it's one of the best animated movies ever. And just the fact that everyone's coming back, get new additions, big additions to the cast. It's fantastic. I think it's great for everybody, especially because I remember when this movie first came out, we were doing the pod at the time. And I remember all three of us kind of unanimously saying, like, is this the point where we hit superhero fatigue? Because, like, it was right, I think, after Infinity War dropped, right? And it was like this and then Aquaman were the back-to-back. I'm like, oh, well, this is the point where we're all going to be like, oh, well, superhero movies are kind of becoming too much. And, man, it was the most refreshing superhero experience we ever could have had. It was fantastic. So I would love for them to just do as many of these movies as they can, because the animated medium, you know, you really open up the possibilities to do anything you want. You're not restricted by CGI or by practical effects, whatever. You can literally do anything you want, and I think that lends to the superhero genre so much more than the live action does. So bravo to them. I'm happy for them, very happy for Lord and Miller.
Yeah, I this will be, especially as somebody who's a huge Spider-Man fan, this might be a hot take here. I like the first Spider-Verse. I think it's fine. I've never understood or gotten already. I apologize for my voice. Like, I'm still recovering from Indy, like I said, but it's fine. It's good. I did not get the people who are like, man, this is the best Spider-Man movie ever. Like, I mean, have you seen Spider-Man 2? Like, I don't know. That was a bit weird to me. I also I don't think it's nearly as original as it thinks it is. Like, it's the video game Shattered Dimensions, just kind of with a twist. That's beside the point. This trailer, I think I think is really good. And I actually am more excited for this. And I think I'll end up liking it more than I enjoyed the first one, because one thing about the first one that they had this really neat kind of hook with all the different Spider-Man, but there was always that moment where I'm like, man, I feel like, because this is, they're still trying to make the Miles Morales movie here, there's so much more that you can do with this potential universe, this potential multiverse. And I love the idea of going through the different dimensions of having, Miguel O'Hara in there, having the 2099 Spider-Man. I think that's really cool. I'm excited to kind of see the next step of that. I hope they bring back some old friends. Like, I think one thing that would be neat about this is that with the first one, you had three or four or five different spider people coming into modern day New York. It looks like with this one, you're going to have modern day New York Spider-Man going into the other different dimensions from the characters of the previous film. So, and the one thing that is spectacular about both these movies already, the animation is unique and original, right? And just, mm-hmm. I mean, it's breathtaking. It's beautiful. What the animation is like a character in the first movie with the way it chooses to tell its story. You've gotten the origin out of the way. So I am really amped for this. I think it's going to be quite good.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. That's a big change, or not a change, but a big difference between this one and the first one is that you're now out of the origin story, which is kind of crazy that's how the first one, though it did take a different take on the origin story. Like, it was very self-referential and meta in terms of, like, comparing it to Spider-Man, Spider-Man's Amazing Spider-Man, and not as much Homecoming, because Homecoming didn't do the traditional tropes because he was introduced in Civil War. But yeah, that's basically I think maybe the biggest intrigue point is that it is going to be different, because you're going to see a story that doesn't have to rely on explaining a character to you, even though, again, it did it very well. But I think it opens it up to some kind of crazier possibilities, which is pretty cool. So yeah, next year.
So many Spider-Men too. It's crazy. Like if you're listening to this, you should definitely look up just how many iterations of Spider-Man there are, because there are just, it's like an endless world that already exists for Lord and Miller to just kind of tap into and bring in whatever they want. Like, I'm just looking at a list on like fucking ScreenRant right now. It's like Spiderling, never heard of that before. Like Scarlet Spider, I've vaguely heard of before. Cool, you know, I remember the cool costume, whatever. Man Spider, all these other different sort of Spider-Punk. All these different Spider-Men, like all of them could make an appearance in anything like this. And I think that is something, if you're like a more of a casual Spider-Man fan like me, where like, oh, my experience is very limited to the movies and the shows, like you're definitely going to love this shit.
Wasn't Man Spider the name of Frank Reynolds' Halloween character in that episode of Always Sunny?
I think
Sunny.
If it's Always Sunny, yeah.
Yeah,
I think
it, was, so. It wasn't Spider-Man, I was Man Spider.
Yeah, because he always rips off other IPs, and he's just like, right. It's like, I wasn't Rambo, that wasn't Rambo, that was me, that was my story. Like, right. Oh, yeah. You're just making up Rambo. You're just doing Rambo.
Yeah. I'm the Japanese Spider-Man, and I'm very excited for that inclusion. That's going to be...
Spider-Wolf? There's a Spider-Wolf? Dude, this is crazy. It's like just a cosmic Spider-Man. There's so many Spider-Men. Too many Spider-Men, some would say, but that's perfect for the Lord Miller.
So that's that on Spider-Verse. Other Spider-Man news, not as crazy. Amy Pascal of Sony said that there's going to be another Tom Holland Spider-Man trilogy, which that makes complete sense. You figured it would just be a three and done for him. Apparently the next trilogy will focus more on Tom Holland's Peter Parker and less on it being MCU involvement. You have to figure that means Sinister Six. There was a first clip release for Morbius, which is not the living vampire starring Jared Leto, which comes out in January. We'll just tie all the Spider-Man news into it. He referenced very heavily that Morbius is part of the Sinister Six. Like he basically said he's part of the Sinister Six. What people are assuming is that the Sinister Six will be all the Sony Spider-Man villains, but also including Mysterio and Michael Keaton's Vulture. People not totally sure which Vulture is showing up in Morbius. Is it the MCU Vulture? Is it a variant of Vulture for Michael Keaton? But he is in the movie. But it does seem to suggest that the Sinister Six will very much involve Morbius, probably Kraven the Hunter, played by Aaron Taylor Johnson. Mysterio, Vulture, probably Venom. Sony's obsessed with Venom. And I guess people are. so you have
don't
to
forget that. Venom. Our screening, people went ballistic for Venom. Venom fans go nuts.
I think we'll probably see Venom in a post-credit scene next week. And I don't know, that's not a spoiler. I've tapped out pretty hard on spoilers with No Way Home. I don't want it ruined. So I don't know. And I don't even think that has leaked. We'll see. So that was kind of the big takeaway from the Morbius trailer or the Morbius first clip. But then the last thing is that the first screening for Spider-Man No Way Home was only 40 minutes, apparently. Mm-hmm. There is going to be a screening next week on the same night of the premiere, but it's only going to be 2 days before the release. We'll see if people spoil shit. Obviously, that happened with Eternals. People tweeted out the Harry Styles thing at the end of Eternals, which, grand scheme of things, big deal. No, it's not like they spoiled No, I'm Your Father from Empire Strikes Back. It's not like they spoiled like a huge, insane thing. But the point, you know, my irritation with all of that is still, it's like you have people from a legacy Hollywood media outlet who just tweeted out shit from a fucking movie 2 weeks before it released because they just could, and they did it for clout and for no other reason because they knew they'd get retweets. So that's why it's always pissed me off, but I imagine that was a big reason why they have not, they've not shown Spider-Man yet.
It's like they tweeted out how Egon Spengler is coming back to Ghostbusters in ghost form. That would have been a major thing. Unlike this,
the last Spider-Man came out, I think press screenings were like a week and a half before. So this is going to be closer to it. This movie's already been leaked so much. Some of the soundtrack leaked over the weekend.
Yeah,
that got CND'd though, or that got not even CND'd. That just got like a copyright suit, I think. That got pulled. So that's kind of where we stand with Spider-Man and screenings. Ken Jack and I we're not going to go see a screening for it. We're just going to go on opening night. Tickets were very hard to get, especially on AMC. I got them at like 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning. However, I do think AMC's system was jammed up because they're giving out NFTs. I think that was a big reason why their system was so fucked. So if you got Spider-Man tickets, congrats.
Congrats
on that.
The Morbius thing, I think more than anything, makes me laugh because it just reminds me about how Tyrese Gibson said very confidently that Morbius is part of the MCU and had to backtrack it so fast, which is very, very funny. And Morbius, I think we kind of agreed there's potential for it to be cool only because like the scary elements, which is something that might get like expounded on in Multiverse of Madness. But like this will be like kind of our first primer to something like that. But I'm so out on Jared Leto, especially just after House of Gucci. I'm so Leto'd out. Like I have Leto fatigue. I think most of society in general has Leto fatigue from dating back to Suicide Squad. But beyond that, I'm happy Sony's making at least an attempt to cover up the leaks. It does feel like they're just like a leaking boat. And every time they patch one leak, another leak opens up. There's just nothing they can do. Just constantly leaking nonstop. So good for them for at least trying to do something about it. And at least for you screener junkies out there, all like the media outlet guys, you get to go and watch it with the regular folks, with the, you know, with the proletariat, unlike instead of having to watch it with like Richard Brody from the New York Times or whatever else, those old bastards. Come watch it with the fans. You'll enjoy it more.
Yeah. Exactly. And as far as Morbius goes, I'm very unenthused. First of all, the movie was supposed to come out like 3 fucking years ago. Now, obviously that's not the film's fault. It's, you know, COVID delays. They're going to try to build up to Sinister Six here. We'll talk about this at some point down the road. Venom 2 was like one of the worst movies I've ever seen in my life. And so I could go literally the next decade without hearing the word Venom, and I'd probably be pretty happy, but that's beside the point. Going back to what you brought up, Jeff, about the next potential Spider-Man trilogy with Tom Holland. My theory is he's going to end up being to the current version of the MCU what Tony Stark was to the previous version, where people forget the last Iron Man movie was 2013, but he showed up in Age of Ultron, Civil War, Infinity War, Endgame. I feel like, especially as Tom Holland gets older, he's going to become kind of the headliner of the next step, leading up to the next group of Avengers that come along. And I do think at some point there's going to be something of a proverbial passing of the torch, where Miles Morales over the last, really, you could say the last 10, but especially the last 5 years, has grown exponentially in popularity and recognizability. Spider-Verse obviously being big reason for that, but those PS4 PS5 games are huge, and the Miles Morales game was awesome. So I think that there at some point there will kind of be they'll bring him into the fold, and I think that's the right idea, because regardless of what happens in No Way Home, I have a relatively educated guess, it is massive. I mean, it is the biggest, it's the show-stopping Spider-Man movie that we've waited for a long time. You kind of can't go bigger than that. So I would like to see them kind of revert back to what made Homecoming really good, which is this kind of intimate Peter Parker story. It's one of the complaints I feel like I might have about No Way Home, which is that it's so massive. It's hard to really have that very human story about this particular version of Spider-Man, as excited as I am for No Way Home. That is something I'm concerned about. I think going forward, being able to tell those kind of more human stories, I think is something that I'll be excited to see what happens with Sony and that universe and the Sinister Six. I don't know if they know. I don't know if Kevin Feige knows. I'm sure there's been a lot of, many conversations and boardroom meetings about it. But for the time being, for the most part, this news is it's exciting. I mean, I can't wait for No Way Home. I think it's going to be awesome.
Tom Holland talked about that, about being kind of like the Tony Stark character and being the Robert Downey Jr. of the universe. And I mean, 3 more movies, that puts it out to, if they're doing like an every other year thing, that puts it out to like 6 more years. So it does kind of all make sense. And there'll probably be a little more of a gap depending on team up stuff. You have to figure he's going to be the leader of the Avengers, at least be around for, whether it's Kang the Conqueror or team up with the X-Men. John Watts, the director of the Spider-Man trilogy. I don't know if he's moving on, but he's doing Fantastic Four. So I can't imagine he's going to do both of them. He might, but I imagine there could be a different director. But I do agree. A more personal Spider-Man story is kind of what I would prefer there as well. Shifting gears to DC, a new trailer for Peacemaker. James Gunn released the spinoff of the Suicide Squad starring John Cena. Chris, where do you stand? Were you the Suicide Squad guy? Ken Jack and I liked it quite a bit. Yeah. And I think we're not on the fence, but we're not crazy about the Peacemaker series, but it's James Gunn, so it's kind of hard to deny that.
Mm-hmm. I enjoyed the Suicide Squad. I was a bit disappointed by it. It's substantially better than its predecessor. The characters are way better. But I really, what didn't work for me is I have a weird sense of humor. I did not find the film as funny as the movie seemed to find itself. I think it was much better, more in line with what I hoped a Suicide Squad movie would be. With that said, I actually really like this trailer, and it's this even more so than the film that came out a couple months ago falls more in line with what I hoped a Suicide Squad film would be. And that is one of the issues. I didn't even talk about it in my review. That's one of the issues I had with the Suicide Squad as a whole, was like, even though it is smaller and the characters are way better, it still ends with kind of a let's save the world storyline. And I feel like that's not, like, part of the joke about the Suicide Squad is they're pretty incompetent. And so for it to end with them fighting a giant CG starfish, I was like, oh, okay, whatever. With this, it's more scaled down. And it seems like there's more character stuff. And I'm actually more excited for it than I thought I'd be. I love Robert Patrick in anything. I feel like it's been a minute, mm-hmm, since he's had like a high profile role, I think. And like, perfect casting to me is John Cena's dad. So I am, I have some trepidations about it, because I think James Gunn's humor has a tendency to be a little bit obnoxious when it doesn't work. So I'm kind of worried about that. But it does look to be better than I expected it would be. So I am excited for it.
For sure. No, I totally agree. I think with James Gunn, he's obviously, I think, kind of proven himself to be good at doing the ensemble, right? Where like he's able to like kind of spread out his plot points, his characterization among multiple characters. I think what excites me about this series is seeing if he can flesh out something across the length of a series versus a movie. If he can do a more of an intimate, you're focusing on this one guy versus a crew sort of movie, and just seeing how he manages to do with the character, what he manages to do with the character of Peacemaker, because I think that Peacemaker was really, really funny, I thought, and probably like the funniest part of Suicide Squad, because John Cena has like insanely good and underappreciated comedic timing. So like seeing how he's able to, do this across a full series versus like in a more of a consolidated short moments, because I'm not sure if he's a character that was just like that for Suicide Squad, where like, man, he was really good in moments, and then you expand upon him like, oh, I don't know, because we kind of, I think, all, at least you and me, Jeff, I think we agreed with the Agatha series, where like we didn't really think that that's a smart idea, because like,
right,
Agatha was really, really great in very short moments for WandaVision, but like, do we want to see that in a full series? With Peacemaker, I think that there's more of an open air because of him being more of like a, just like comically large, disproportionate human being that John Cena is, and having that great comedic ability that he has. So I think there's just a little bit more room to grow. So I just hope it's good. Like, people always say, like, we're Marvel shills, we're Disney shills, whatever. The bigger thing is we're entertainment shills. So like, we don't care. We want DC stuff to be great. We want more stuff like Suicide Squad. We want them to be exceptional, because that's just more great stuff for us to watch. And I would love if DC could kick off like another great high profile DC show, because they've had stuff like Doom Patrol is awesome. All of their animated stuff is really, really good. But like, just like a new super high profile thing, kick off their own version of like doing stuff like Disney's been doing with them.
Right.
All the MCU shows.
Right. I mean, it's like not an offense to like the Flash or the DC shows, but there's a quality difference. Like, you saw that going from the Netflix and Marvel stuff to the Disney Plus Marvel stuff. Like, there's an attention to detail, quality, a production level to it. And I'm not saying that always means it's better, but it's still nice to see that happen to DC stuff. So yeah, I mean, I'm looking forward to it, but again, he wasn't my favorite character in that movie, but I think maybe having his own solo thing could kind of lend to something pretty great, because he is funny in it. And he has the comedic chops. We've seen that from Cena. And then last thing, no, I mean, this doesn't really, this isn't massive news because I feel like we've just kind of known, Charlie Cox is the Daredevil in the MCU, is the MCU's Daredevil, excuse me. That was confirmed by Kevin Feige yesterday. He said, whenever he shows up, if, when, how, why, it will be Charlie Cox, which is not a shock. I think if you're paying attention to Hawkeye right now, you see with the Echo character, we're all pretty sure we saw Kingpin's hand last week in the third episode of Hawkeye. You're assuming that Kingpin is about to show up either this week or next week in Hawkeye. Some people think it's this week. I always thought it made sense next week because you do it Wednesday, you have Kingpin, and then on Thursday night, you likely have what seems to be the reappearance of Charlie Cox as Peter Parker's lawyer, so not Daredevil, as his lawyer in No Way Home. So that's cool. But we'll see how that lines up. But it seems like the Daredevil universe or the Daredevil side of things for the Marvel Cinematic Universe is being introduced probably most officially this week, if not next week. And I assume that's why it's very odd for Kevin Feige to make an announcement like that. And I assume it's because getting ahead of it for what would have seemed to be Kingpin's appearance either this Wednesday or next Wednesday in the MCU. So still cool character people loved. Just a neat confirmation because I'm excited to see him back.
I got to ask one question though, because I've only seen so much. I was part of the first season of Daredevil and I really enjoyed it. I just never got around to finishing it. Has Charlie Cox been in anything else other than those
movies?
Yeah, that series. Like, because he's really good in that role and he's really believable and likable. It seems like he hasn't taken off. But it's been several years though since that series ended.
He was really, really good, and we interviewed him. I remember we talked to him about it. Boardwalk Empire. He was exceptional in that.
Okay.
He was in, I think, he's in a couple movies too. I can't name off the top of my head. Nothing where it's like, holy shit, he was so good in this movie.
Yeah, nothing.
But, like, he's been in stuff. Yeah. But man, he was really, really good in the role of Daredevil. And they confirmed like the Marvel reboot version of Daredevil a while ago. Or something like that. And I think it would have been insane if they tried to do it with anyone else, because like you see, I think more than almost any other actor fit into the character from the Netflix Marvel shows, like Charlie Cox was Daredevil. He's the best on-screen Daredevil. Everyone connected with that. And like everyone loved him as Daredevil. He's wanted to be back as Daredevil. Do you remember when the first No Way Home trailer dropped? People thought they saw his arm and the internet was fucking ablaze for 2 weeks. He was trending for like literally forever. Just Charlie Cox trending because they thought they saw his arm in the No Way Home trailer. Like, people love him as a character. It would be crazy, I think, if they tried to do anyone else, because like it would be that meme. Like, nobody liked that. Like, everybody disliked that if they try to recast Daredevil at all with any other actor.
If he's in No Way Home, which I think he is, I mean, we've kind of you can search it out, but you could argue it's been almost confirmed by some people. No Way Home is going to have two credit sequences. Wouldn't shock me at all if there's one that implies him kind of returning back to Daredevil in some capacity, because I think it wouldn't shock me either if in the Blade movie that's going to be coming out with Mahershala Ali, there's some sort of crossover there. I feel like those are two characters that would work really well together. So especially if he's just in it as the lawyer, wouldn't surprise me if it ends with kind of the implication that, hey, he's the lawyer, but he's still Daredevil. I think that'd be interesting.
Yeah, and I'm also, man, curious what the post-credit scene is going to be next week for Spider-Man No Way Home, because a lot of people seem to imply it's going to be Venom, which that makes sense, but will it be Multiverse of Madness? I'm not sure. It seems like we're getting a Doctor Strange trailer in the next 2 weeks. It seems like Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness trailer will be tied to Spider-Man No Way Home, which makes complete sense. So is it a Daredevil thing? Do we get another Kang the Conqueror thing? Like, you're going to have to start introducing Jonathan Majors in a few other ways, especially because there's so many variants of that character. And what seems to be the MCU's big bad, or at least one of them coming up in the near future. Before we get to the back half of news, just a couple quick things. Episode brought to you by Manscaped. This episode brought to you by Manscaped. Fellas. Manscaped best-selling product is the Performance Package 4.0. At the top of every man's wish list. You got the lawnmower, body trimmer, best trimmer on the market for your balls, butt, body. the weed whacker ear and nose search from a no nick safe to you're not going to nick the parts of your body you do not want bleeding. They promise it, and I trust them. We've used them for a while now. You know that. Get the performance package now to receive their two free gifts, too. The boxers, Manscaped boxers, and the Shed travel bag. It's awesome. This is what you get. Manscaped right here. Ready? Stocking stuffers. Manscaped 2-in-1 shampoo and conditioner. Just launched. Awesome. Manscaped cologne-infused body wash. Shears 2.0 luxury four-piece nail kit. Crop mops or ball wipes. There you go. How about that? Manscaped signature cologne. All vegan, cruelty-free, dye-free, sulfate-free, paraben-free. So, you know, these are legit products. Make sure you hurry up right now. Manscaped, manscaped.com/lights. Get 20% off and free shipping. Get 20% off and free shipping at manscaped.com/lights, folks. All right, few casting things, and then we'll get into our reviews. Channing Tatum back for Magic Mike's Last Dance.
Mm-hmm. I love that.
I mean, look, Magic Mike, the first Magic Mike, I think, is a pretty good movie. Well above average, pretty fucking solid movie from Steven Soderbergh. It was a surprise of 2012. But there was a pretty large difference between the first and the second one, which the second one was fun. It was fun. It wasn't great by any means. There was no Matthew McConaughey in the second one. It was much different in that sense. However, I don't know. I like that he's back. Steven Soderbergh back too. Why not? Why not have fun with it? Why not? It won't be the first one. It won't be the surprise of that, but why not?
It's got Soderbergh back, got the same writer. You got obviously Channing Tatum back. These movies are like dudes rock movies for girls. Like, and also dudes rock movies for dudes. They're dudes rock movies for everybody. And there's an endearing quality, especially to that first one. And that kind of got lost a little bit in the second one. And then again, that might've been like you were saying, the McConaughey effect. But I think you can kind of reclaim it in this third one. Sign off with a bang, let Channing Tatum do his thing, be charming. And like, it's funny, we were talking about Phil Lord and Chris Miller earlier. Like, you watch him in 21 Jump Street, which had come back to Netflix last month. Man, he's so fucking funny and so charming and so great. And just his physical presence and ability to dance too, which is also sneaky great. I think that's really what makes these movies so like endearing. So I know I'm very much for this.
Yeah, I haven't seen either one, but I really like Channing Tatum a lot, and I love his career arc because, dude, I'll be real, man. I thought he was the shittiest actor for a long time. Like, Step Up, and I remember I saw G.I. Joe in theaters and thinking that there were like middle school plays that had like deeper, better acting in it. Like, I was very, and he was like the worst of them. And he had that year in 2012. I think he'd been in stuff, smaller stuff, like Guide to Recognizing Your Saints, stuff like that, that I'd heard he was quite good in. But he had that year with 21 Jump Street and Magic Mike. And then he just kind of kept coming back and hitting home runs. And he gave to me one of the more underrated performances it's almost 8 years now, where he, Foxcatcher. He's brilliant in Foxcatcher. And he was in the Hail Caesar movie where he was singing and dancing. And he was really good in that. Now he's become one of those actors where I miss him. I feel like it's been a minute since he had a cameo in Free Guy. And it reminded me, like, it's one of the things about that movie I don't like, because every time he's on screen, I'm like, where's this guy been? I like this guy. He's a good actor. So, and I love, isn't the official title like Magic Mike's Last Dance? Like,
yeah,
such an over the top title. Yeah, right. Exactly. So, yeah, you're right.
He has not been in a live action movie with a main role since Kingsman: The Golden Circle.
And that was not really a main role.
Yeah.
Right. So then really his last main role was Logan Lucky.
Mm. Wow. Yeah. So
really good in that too.
Good for him. Yeah. No, I've always liked him, man. Or not always. Definitely not always. But I'm glad he's come around over the last like decade or so. I think he's a really talented guy.
Will he play Gambit? That's always the big question.
Yep.
No one wants a role more.
Never confirmed.
Nick Cage going to be playing Dracula in the Renfield movie from Universal's Monster series. Not a lot out on this yet, though. Look, Universal rebooted the Dark Universe in a much different way. We obviously got the Invisible Man, but like kind of the Blumhouse version of it. Nick Cage has been fantastic in these wacky horror movies, like these Shudder type movies. He's been awesome in them. Some have been amazing. Some have been, I think, less than stellar, but still very entertaining. You know, from the Mandys to the Mom and Dad. So we'll see. I think this is cool, but I'm hesitant. It's impossible, no matter how good something like Invisible Man might be or those types of movies, it's impossible to not be hesitant a little bit when it comes to Universal's monsters after what happened with the Dark Universe, right?
Should post that picture from the LCB account, the Dark Universe picture.
Might have
where to. They're all green screen together.
Yeah.
But I think this character, or at least the story, sounds interesting, right? It's originated from the Bram Stoker version. It's patient in an asylum, obsessed with drinking blood, deluded to think he'll find immortality. He bows the feet of Dracula, becomes his thrall, but it's a codependent, toxic workplace experience. And it's just kind of like, it reminds me a lot of what do we call it? What We Do in the Shadows, like the thrall to vampire relationship, which is something they did a bunch in the new series. Obviously, the series and the movie were inspired a lot by the Bram Stoker Dracula. But I love that. I think it's Nicholas Holt. Like, Nicholas Holt is a fantastic actor.
Yeah.
Recently binged The Great on Hulu, where he plays like Peter the Great, or Peter, the Emperor, Russian Emperor Peter. And he's fantastic in that. I think their combo would be amazing because, again, Nick Cage, man, dude gives 110%, doesn't matter what the role is, always going to give you like the maximum effort performance. I really like this like sort of idea for him too, because he does kind of have like a Dracula sort of like a face. I don't know how to explain it. Like, you look at him, you're like, yeah, that guy can play Dracula. He's got the sharp widow's peak. He's got all that shit. He think he can really pull this off. And I think that like this sort of dangling immortality in front of Nicholas Holt while he tries to get it. And like, I think that could be a really funny codependent or sort of a relationship. And I'm very excited for this.
Yeah. The more you guys talk about it, the more intrigued I get as well. I agree with you, man. I like Nicholas Holt a lot as an actor. I mean, he stood out to me in that movie, The Favorite, which is very good.
Oh, so good in that. Yeah.
Very good. But man, it's a movie with some crazy bitches, man. And he does a great job of kind of being like the straight person throughout it. And just that, like the way he handles, I found him very amusing and very good in that great movie. I mean, one of the better movies of that year. But I think the reason I'm intrigued by this is I think Nick Cage as an actor works way better when he has people to bounce off of, where like you look at his like famous memeable performances, it's just him going crazy. But when you look at something like Kick-Ass, when it's him and Chloe Moretz or him and Aaron Taylor Johnson kind of working off each other, Mark Strong, I feel like he works better in an ensemble. I think that's why people in hindsight connect with those National Treasure movies, because yes, it's him in the lead role, but it's you got this little ensemble group with Diane Kruger and you have Justin Bartha and obviously John Voight. And I'm like, I think allows himself to be
Justin Bartha.
Yeah, right, that's right. He allows himself to be a little bit more restrained. I hope we see something like that here, because I don't know, he's just always one of those actors I believe in. And I do think he has like this really huge, like potential career turnaround coming. He's, you know, gone through the indie circuit here over the last several years to a lot of success. And I don't know, I always root for Nicolas Cage. I always find him amusing. I think I said this in the review I did for Willy's Wonderland, which is not a movie I liked, but he's the only actor I think in the world who is incomparable to any other actor. You don't get Nicolas Cage confused with anybody. It's either Nick Cage or it's everybody else. And I root for a guy with that kind of originality as a performer. So I hope this is good.
That's very true. I never really thought about it that way, but there's not many actors out there where you could be like, yeah, they have a very Nicolas Cage quality to them. Like, no, not really. Like, I don't think that exists.
My concern though is, and I actually think I trust him. I trust that he will. I trust that he will take the right roles, which I think is half the battle. But I just hope that these studios aren't like, oh, there's a Nick Cage assance going on. Let's just get Nick Cage to do wacky Nick Cage. Like, I hope there's a care to it, because that's why these smaller movies have worked, because they've crafted to his style and they've been enjoyable. And I think Mandy's probably the best example of that. Even if you didn't love Mandy, like you're like, okay, that is something different. Like, he fits that perfectly. So I just hope they, again, that's a gun shy thing with anything related to the Dark Universe, because it was fumbled so badly that it's hard to have good, like, there's not a lot of goodwill going around for the Universal Monsters right now.
And the point, yeah. The point you bring up is, I think an actor who almost went through a similar thing where it's like, is this guy being shoved down our throats with his resurgence was Matthew McConaughey, but he chose really good projects. I think when you have an actor like Nicolas Cage, who's been around forever, I think he's, you know, got to be good financially. Well, shit, didn't he go bankrupt?
He had to sell his dinosaur skull back to the government of Mongolia.
That's right. He owned Octopi or something like that. So maybe I meant that statement, but I think that the older you get as an actor, the less you care about being a movie star and the more you care about actually taking on projects that matter to you. So I think he's kind of in that position at this point. I do hope he has that, like, that little resurgence. It'd be amazing. The world needs more Nicolas Cage again in the forefront.
I'm the only movie that McConaughey really, really whiffed on was when he didn't play Ego the Living Planet and then did The Dark Tower instead.
Oh, fuck,
it wasn't
that.
Guardians, yeah, 2. That was so bad. I still wanted to be Norman Osborn. I wanted to be Norman Osborn so bad. I don't think that's going to happen. No. That's it. That's it for news. This episode of Lights, Camera, Barstool, though, brought to you by Nomad Goods. This episode brought to you by Nomad Goods. They were a Kickstarter project in 2012 based in Santa Barbara. They wanted to make ultra rugged minimalist tools for 21st century Nomad. They have such good charging cables, double braided Kevlar outer sheath for their cables, for charging cables. And they work so well too. Fast charging. They have great docking station. They have a great mouse pad. They have so many awesome gifts. Nomad is absolutely outstanding. Nomad, Nomad goods.com/lights. Nomad Goods, we got to try out a bunch of them. Man, they are awesome. I went back and ordered a ton. I have this leather case on my phone. It doesn't even tear up either. Same leather case for AirPods, a wallet, triple charging station, so many things. If you're a tech person, and by that I mean if you just have a fucking phone, Nomad Goods is the way to go. Go to Nomad Goods, great spot to find so many things, especially if you're buying stuff for people this holiday season. Nomadgoods.com/lights. All right, thanks to Nomad Goods. Let's get into our reviews. First up is The Power of the Dog, a movie that right now, so Gold Derby is probably the best website for getting a good consensus of what is considered the favorite, not the favorite for the Oscars. Two of the three movies we're going to talk about are absolutely considered front runners for Best Picture. One of them being The Power of the Dog, the other being Belfast. We'll talk about Belfast a little bit in a moment. But The Power of the Dog, released in theaters and then on Netflix. So you can go watch this now on Netflix. A domineering rancher responds with mocking cruelty when his brother brings home a new wife and her son until the unexpected comes to pass. Benedict Cumberbatch in the lead role as Phil Burbank. Kirsten Dunst plays the wife that arrives on the scene, the wife of Jesse Plemons, who plays George Burbank, the brother of Benedict Cumberbatch's Phil. And then Cody Smith McPhee plays Peter Gordon, who plays the son of Kirsten Dunst's character. And that is the two of those characters are kind of where the story takes its turns and what everything is based around. Again, they're ranchers. It is directed by Jane Campion, who has done a lot of movies, but nothing of massive note in a while. In the early 90s, she released a couple movies that are all in the Criterion Collection. Mm-hmm. Two of them being An Angel at My Table, the other being Sweetie, which are smaller movies. The one of most note is The Piano, which...
Yeah, that went up against Spielberg for Best Picture, I think, right? And yeah. It's kind of funny because that could theoretically be happening again this year.
Yep. Fantastic, right. Right, which West Side Story, by the way, people saw West Side Story. We didn't get a chance to go to the screening because we had our Cyber Monday sale. I'm going to see it. I'm excited to see it Thursday night. It's apparently people are like, I don't know why this movie just fits the bill for Best Picture at the Oscars. Whether it is the Best Picture, I don't know, but people who have seen it are like, this is just something that the fucking Academy would pick to win.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was nominated for so many things: Best Picture, Director, Actress, Supporting Actress, Screenplay, Cinematography, Costume Design, Film Editing. Holly Hunter and Anna Paquin both won. Anna Paquin very famously became the youngest actress to win an acting award at that time when she won for The Piano. How old was she? She's
like 12, wasn't she?
She was really fucking young.
Yeah.
I forget what her age was. Anyway, so the Holly Hunter won for Best Actress. So again, if you haven't seen any of her movies, go check them out. They're older movies, at least ones of note. This is a newer one, and she's going to be up for a lot of awards for this movie. But I guess the question is, do we agree with that? I like this movie. I think it's a really good movie. I was captivated by it. I think it takes turns and twists that are really fucking dark. It's a dark movie. I think it takes some really intriguing turns. I think the ending is a fantastic ending. I think there are parts of the movie that in some cases, like we'll talk about Belfast. And they're two wildly different movies because Belfast does have some, I guess, quote unquote, negative moments, but it's a much more upbeat movie. I've seen people call both movies at some points maybe a little too drawn out or quote unquote boring. But I think the only one I would say that about between the two of these would be The Power of the Dog. There's just some parts of the movie that drag a little bit for me where I'm not quite as captivated, and it kind of takes away from, I think, the mystery of the story. Does it play into the fact that I was kind of surprised by the twist it takes at the end? Yes, we'll get into that in a second. We'll spoil right up the top. But other than that, it's a really good, strong movie. It looks fucking great. The acting is awesome. The acting carries the movie. Everyone in this movie, I think, does a pretty superb job, especially given the fact that this is such a dark story. It's a 90 out of 100 for me. It's definitely up there with some of the better movies of the year. I mean, I really enjoyed it. I think Benedict Cumberbatch is awesome. I think we oddly forget that Benedict Cumberbatch is such a fucking stout actor. Not that he does a bad job with Doctor Strange, but he's so much Doctor Strange right now that it's one of the things like, oh, I forgot that he's just like, before Marvel, is just a really good fucking actor. And he's great in this. We'll get into the meat. I think the more interesting thing about this movie is how you view the ending and how you view the story put together. And I think there's also a way, and I'm wondering if either the two of you agree with this or have this take, because I don't agree with it, but I know some people have, is the way the movie plays out convoluted in a sense with how it ends. And we'll spoil it in a second, but 90 out of 100 for me, I do not think it's the best movie of the year. I don't think it really sniffs the top. I know I have an unconventional one. I'm obviously obsessed with Dune, but I also know that we just saw something, Ken, Jack and I at least did, Licorice Pizza, that is up there as well. I don't think this is up there even with the Judas and the Black Messiahs, even though that I know does not count for best picture this year, but that's still a 2021 movie. So that's my point. Mm-hmm. 90 out of 100 for me. Ken, Jack, where do you have it?
I ended up on an 88. I think the primary goal of this movie was to kind of keep the audience on its toes, right? And I think in that regard, complete and total success, right? Like it's very, very unsettling. It very much just keeps you like a little bit unnerved throughout the entire movie. So on that level, I think as a primary objective, so to speak, I love that. I think it's the movie that makes you feel like a fight is about to break out at any second, but it just consistently sort of teeters on the right on the edge of that without breaking through, which I found very smart. It's not something you see in a movie often. Like usually if like an animosity is building throughout a movie, like you get like the true explosive sort of resolution to it. And like you sort of don't hear, which I thought was kind of smart on Campion's part. And I really enjoyed that. But really, I think what makes the movie good more than anything else is the performances, or are the performances. Cumberbatch, he's so good as a bad guy here. He's like a brilliant bastard in this movie. And he's so unnerving. And I think that he really does a good job of reminding probably a lot of us of at least one person in our life, like someone that like you try to keep your distance from because they have that air that they might pop off. You know what I mean? Like we're just like, I'm just going to keep a respectful distance away from this person. And I think he just did a really, really good job there. Our thick boy, Jesse Plemons. Awesome. Awesome job in this. We love him. Got called fatso a lot as a fellow fat. Thought that was fucked up, but it reminded me how funny the word fatso is. also, I thought that, he did a really good job with his real life wife. I thought that Kirsten Dunst, this is my favorite Dunst role maybe ever. I think she's fantastic. She really makes you feel that sort of like, I'm trapped here and I don't know what to do mentality. And like, she obviously delving into alcoholism and all that. Cody Smith McPhee, someone who like, every time I see him, like, oh, that's who's he an X-Men Nightcrawler or something? I'm saying, guy.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. It's a very distinct look about him. So like that is usually the only thing I can focus on, but I think he did a good job here of being like just a very interesting character. You know, like you feel like you do get this sort of like weak son character, in especially in Western movies a lot. And I think that he did a good sort of he did his own spin on it very well. I think the storyline in the movie gets a little bit wonky, and that's definitely where I'll take off points from it. It thinks it's a lot smarter than it actually is. It's like, we need to make things feel a little bit airier, a little more open-ended, a little more this, in order for people to think that it's like a very good movie. And it's like, you can have things be a little bit more definitive. You can have things be a little bit more close-ended without, like, because that's where it airs out and turns into almost like a pretentious movie. You know what I mean? Like, that's like that, there's that thin line where someone watching this, especially on Netflix, which are just mostly, you know, regular, like, you know, Joe Smith, whatever guys and girls, like, they're just watching this to find a good movie. Like, they'll watch this and think, like, I'm sure this is very pretentious and I don't like this. And that's where it kind of loses it a little bit. And it reminds me a lot of another Netflix movie, which with Jesse Plemons, which was I'm Thinking of Ending Things. You remember that from last year?
Where it was
like
Charlie Kaufman. Yeah.
Yeah. And we were watching that, where it's like, there is very good things about this movie. No one is going to connect with this. I think that movie is way more like out of left field than this movie is, but this movie definitely has moments in the storyline that definitely, like, I think will turn a lot of people off, turn me off a little bit too. But I think the thing that elevates it more than anything else, performances were out of this world across the board and really headlined by Cumberbatch.
Yeah. I've been looking forward to talking about this because I saw David Lowery's The Green Knight, I think in August. And I said, well, no competition. This is going to be the weirdest movie of 2021. That is Star Wars compared to some of the bizarre shit that we get in Power of the Dog. That does not make it bad. I know there's politicking involved, but I will say, if this wins Best Picture, I think to mainstream audiences, the Oscars will officially be dead, because I see this being a movie that mainstream audiences just do not like. It's not very long, but it feels very long. It is not cut and dry with its characters. It does pull off something that I appreciate, which is its main character. It's like somebody watched There Will Be Blood and said, God, this Daniel Plainview, he's just too nice. And so they decided to write Benedict Cumberbatch's character, who's just this malicious douchebag. And he's brilliant. And I agree, like you said, Jeff, he has almost become underrated as a performer, because I don't know, he gets memed for his name and shit like that. But you watch this guy in Star Trek or Imitation Game. This guy's one of the best actors working. Everybody's great in it. I do like this movie, by the way. I do have to say, I do enjoy it. I more so appreciate it for what it was and what it was trying to be. It suffers from, to me, what many kind of Oscar bait movies suffer from, which is it's overly long. I still think you could cut a solid chunk out of it. It took a minute for me to kind of figure out what it was. I don't know if we're going to do spoilers for this one.
But we can. Now that we've given we can get into it.
Can we get into it? Okay. Here's the big problem I have with it, is I picked up pretty early on what Benedict Cumberbatch's character was. He's gay. I don't think it's, you know, it's overt, you know, and from like the second scene, I kind of had an idea. The issue is, it feels like the movie kind of portrays it as a twist. Like, can you believe this? And yeah, I could. It felt like they were kind of going that direction. Now, it's handled relatively well. And there's, you know, it's where I think Cumberbatch was just probably salivating reading the script, because this character goes in so many different directions. But it leads to an ending that is interesting, not by no means wholly satisfying. It's one that's open to interpretation. I think that this will be a movie, and that's why I would be surprised if it ended up winning Best Picture. I think it's a movie that over time will become something that's appreciated more so by people. Whereas the Best Picture movie is kind of the movie that in the moment everyone says, this is brilliant. You know, the Titanics of the world, the kind of the mainstream, like, you know, and narratives. There's nothing really outside of the actors being famous, really mainstream about this. Like you guys said, it looks great. It has this weird aura to it where from the very first shot, you're uncomfortable with it. And it's strange because it's not a thriller by any means. It's a very slow moving movie. And yet you watch it and you feel just a level of unease throughout the entire thing. I mean, the characters are all very, very flawed. Everyone kind of throughout this movie has, you know, secrets about their life that you feel like are going to be bubbling up to the surface at any point. The more I talk about it, the more I like it. I'm actually bumping my rating up quite a bit. And this may seem low, but I could see it going higher. I'm gonna put it at an even 70. I like it. I think over time I could enjoy it more. I think there will be people who declare this like the best movie of the year. I guess just for me, it was a little bit too flat at points narratively for me to really say, oh, I can't wait to go back and watch this again and declare it one of the better movies of the year. But it is quite good, and it's memorable, which so many movies are not nowadays.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think for me, I think it just has this like this sensibility to it, which plays it. You're right. It's like almost like a slow thriller in a sense,
yeah,
which I do like. But again, my one big complaint where I kind of drop it from being like truly great, just being like great or like really good, is that I just do think in some spots it kind of drags down what I think are its strengths, and its strengths are the mystery of kind of the character, kind of the mystery of like what's going on with, you know, Kirsten Dunst's characters, the son, like there's a lot of those added elements. I think that if the movie kind of had a bit more punch in that sense, not in a way that it becomes obnoxious and it completely ruins the tone for what Jane Campion is going for, because there's a reason why it works, a reason why she's good at what she does. But I think there could have been met with a little more kind of in between on getting the movie to kind of pack a bit of a faster moving thriller sense to it, because it does move at kind of a slow pace. We'll talk about the what kind of happens here. So Benedict Cumberbatch's character does not like Kirsten Dunst's character at all, kind of ruining the dynamics of the family. Does a lot of things to sabotage her life. She kind of punches back, does a few things as well. And throughout all this, Benedict Cumberbatch's Phil is beginning to have a bond with Peter, who initially he doesn't like, the son of Kirsten Dunst's character, Rose. And you think it's kind of a genuine connection, but in the end, it's heavily implied through... it's heavily implied. I'll say that. It's not like just distinctly said that he kills him, but Peter leads to the death of Benedict Cumberbatch's Phil through a series of events, through a hand injury, through anthrax and cattle. And that's kind of where your mind goes at the end of the movie. It ends in an ambiguous way, but it's not that ambiguous. It's pretty clear what happens. And Jane Campion even said, in interviews, that Peter versus Phil is kind of a David and Goliath type story. There's a very direct reference to the Bible at the end of the movie. And we'll get to that here in a second. But even in the beginning of the movie, like there's a voiceover with Peter's as for what kind of man might I be if I do not help my mother. So you get this kind of, like Ken Jack said, you're on your toes because you're almost like, oh wow, this is a grumpy old like farmer Western type thing, right? Where he doesn't agree with what's going on. He doesn't like this type of thing, but he's going to kind of turn around because he has this young kid he's going to take under his wing. And so I like the idea that you kind of get that sense of what the story is, but really in the end, it's just a revenge thriller. Like it's basically what it becomes, because Peter gets revenge on Phil. Again, that's what's heavily implied for the way he treats his mother.
Mm-hmm.
That's you get from it. Yeah.
It's a one thing I want to note that I almost forget about is that, I think this movie did a really good job beyond with the visual aspect of it, like the because I do think that the way that they shot this movie added to that unsettling nature. I think they did sound really well, like very minuscule use of sound, like when Benedict Cumberbatch is walking through the house in those spurs and you just hear like from anywhere in the house, you just hear the spurs coming through. You kind of feel like that, like you kind of like suck in your teeth and like what's going to happen and you're like what's going to happen there. But as far as like the revenge sort of thriller aspect of it, that's kind of like, it's funny because you only come to that conclusion more towards the end, because really like almost every movie, like you kind of know what the objective of the movie is within like the first, like 20 minutes or so, like, okay, like person A needs to do this. And like, that'll be the end of the movie. Like there's not really that in this, right? It's just like, they're just like living their life.
like as far as we know, like these two, these this family's just going about their business in their day. Like you don't know what is supposed to be happening. And I do like how that sort of wrapped up with Phil just getting kind of killed more or less by what was the Cody Smith McPhee's character's name?
Peter.
Yeah. Him getting killed by Peter. I do like how that ended up wrapping up. That was something I didn't see coming really at all. And I thought that, that the whole fact that he came around to liking Peter too, even was kind of a surprise. To your point, by the way, of Chris too, about the people getting pissed at the Oscars about this. I think that what would makes that even more of a salient point is like, people will get pissed at the Oscars no matter what, right? Like when they're like,
of course, right.
How the fuck did Shape of Water win Best Picture? How the fuck did Moonlight win Best Picture? The difference being that none of these people watch those movies. Everyone that complains about those movies, they never watched those movies. This movie is significantly more accessible since it's on Netflix, which I think will piss people off a lot more.
That's a really good point you just made. And yeah, it's hard to argue. And it is, regardless of, you know, my rating is a little bit lower than your guys's, but I love that these movies do come to Netflix, because I do think that it something like the Oscars, I think, could stay remarkably more relevant when people are able to watch the movies. I mean, like Nomadland, I know you guys are in New York, so it might be a little bit different, but like being where I'm at in Lansing, Michigan, last year, COVID being a big reason for this, Nomadland, I don't believe, ever came to my where I lived. I had to watch it on VOD. Now, eventually, they put it on Hulu and it became a little bit more accessible. No, still nobody watched the Oscars last year, but I do think that with something like this, regardless of how people feel about it, I do think it's going to become a much more talked about movie than your typical Oscar, because I do think there's going to be people who are going to sit down and watch it on Netflix and are going to have the kind of what the fuck reaction that so many people have had to it. And it's why I'm glad I'm doing this podcast now, because as we've talked about it, I've come to appreciate it more. Like I knew it was a really well-made movie, but I think that there's kind of a little idiosyncrasies in this thing that I overlooked when I was watching it.
I don't know. There's few movies that are up for best, that will be up for Best Picture, that are in the discussion that I think can move the needle in terms of the Oscars doing something different that kind of captures a mainstream audience. I think West Side Story is probably going to be number one. That's going to probably be the one candidate in terms of relevancy. Yep. You have a movie that people know the story, they know the actors, they know the director. Like, it's West Side Story. There's no denying that. I think after that, I mean, Dune isn't going to win, but Dune would be one that would pump relevancy. It's a massive hit around the world, but probably King not going to win. Don't Look Up, probably not going to win, but Don't Look Up is definitely going to get a lot of buzz because it's Christmas. It's on Netflix. It's Leo and J-Law. It has a lot of recognizable people. It's, you know, Kid Cudi and Ariana Grande. It's got like a random collection of people. I don't think Don't Look Up's going to win, though. So I really think the only one, King Richard, maybe, because it's been pumped so much, Will Smith. But I don't think King Richard's going to win. So I truly think the only movie that has a chance, and like Licorice Pizza, no, Licorice Pizza is still in like three theaters. It's like mm-hmm. up to 10 theaters across the country. And they're doing that to build hype. I think that's a decent rollout for that movie. Like, I get why they're doing it. But in terms of accessibility and like Oscar relevancy, I think the only one that would really have, that has like a real chance, that would kind of be a mainstream pick would be West Side Story at this point.
Yeah. I will say I would give Licorice Pizza a bit more of a shot because there's always politicking with this stuff. Paul Thomas Anderson has never won Best Director, and he's never made a movie that's won Best Picture. Could be small chance. Could be a Scorsese with The Departed kind of thing where they say, hey, you know what? He's been around forever. Let's throw him a ball and let's give him the Oscar, at least for directing. That's a guess though. I think the one thing that is exciting and intriguing about this year's Oscars is because it's been such a weird year coming off of COVID and the fact that we're only, because of last year being extended, we're only talking about 10 months worth of movies as opposed to the typical 12.
And remember how long it's going to take for it to come. Remember, the Oscars isn't until March because of the Olympics this year.
That's right. Okay. Then, maybe they'll push it again. But I think if there's a year where we're going to see some weird, oh my God, that guy's still around nominations. I mean, Will Smith potentially winning an Oscar is not that surprising. But like, one movie that I'm really amped for, just because like nothing would be more 2021 than the idea of hearing Simon Rex be nominated for an Academy Award. And like, from what I hear, Red Rocket is really, really great. And that's I feel like the acting categories are going to be kind of thin, and we're going to see some people be nominated this year that we're going to look at and go, wow, yeah, God, man, they've been around for a long time, or where have they been? So that does excite me, and I think could make for kind of an interesting, you know, assortment of nominations.
I like the idea of Spielberg potentially winning one, though, in this case, only because that is one where the general public, everyone knows who Spielberg is, right? Everyone knows, mm-hmm. for the most part, at least what West Side Story is. I could see, at least, not that the general public has any say in the Oscars at all. Again, it's a fucking industry award. You guys, all of you listening, including myself, you have no fucking choice. This is an industry award. But I could see people pushing for that because like, he's only won Best Picture once. He's won Best Director twice, but even then, the last time he won it was 1999, like 2 decades without an Oscar win for Steven Spielberg seems crazy. I'm sure that the general public would love that for him, for that's worth.
And you look at last year's show, and I'm just talking about the show in general, was the lowest rated Oscars ever. Yeah. There is no director ever in the history of the world who's more mainstream than Steven Spielberg. Right, if you ask any person just randomly walking on the street, name one film director, highest percentage answer is going to be Steven Spielberg. So if there's ever a year where to kind of get that audience back, you go, it's the equivalent of bringing Billy Crystal back to host the show, where it's like, let's get the kind of tried and true method. Throw a bone to a guy that's been around forever, that every fan knows, that the industry knows. And from what I mean, West Side Story is my most anticipated movie of the year. So, I mean, I'm acting like it's going to be some political thing. He may earn it. I mean, the movie looks amazing. So it'll be a more intriguing award show than it probably has been over the last several years.
Yeah. And we'll get to a little more on the Oscars in a second. We talk about Spencer and talk about if Kristen Stewart is deserving of Best Actress. But I just want to wrap up on kind of the twist here. In the end, we see this Bible verse. Well after Phyllis died, you see Peter looks on smiling at his mom and now his new stepdad, Kirsten Dunst and Jesse Plemons. And he reads a Bible verse, and the Bible verse says, deliver my soul from the sword, my darling, from the power of the dog. And if you look up that Psalm 22, if you look that up, so you go to Wikipedia, probably the best source for anyone wanting to learn about the Bible, three religious lads here. In the most general sense, Psalm 22 is about a person who's crying out to God to save him from the taunts and torments of his enemies, and in the last 10 verses, thanking God for rescuing him. So, I mean, it's on the nose. It's not on the nose, but it's clear that he, you know, the intention was to kill him. And I think the more you read into the idea that Jane Campion views this as a David versus Goliath thing, which David versus Goliath, very tied into that Bible verse and Psalm and all that from everything I've read, it makes complete sense. And it's kind of a cool way to look at it. And that made me appreciate, I think, the movie even more is that, you know, think about the ways he, like, I've seen some criticism, like, it's so random how he killed him, right? Like, there are, it's not like everything was completely planned. He couldn't have planned the hand cut. He couldn't have planned, you know, finding a cow with anthrax, but it does have this, it made me appreciate the kind of David versus Goliath, like, you know, he used the things that came his way to take down somebody who stood in the way of his mother. And again, what he said in the beginning of the movie on the voiceover, for what kind of man might I be if I do not help my mother? So I thought that was that again, that made me truly appreciate the story that was crafted here.
I just, the one thing I wanted in that movie more than anything else was for Jesse Plemons to just punch Benedict Cumberbatch in the face. He just got run roughshod. Benedict Cumberbatch is riding his ass the entire movie. And he's just sitting there like, what did you say, brother? And just like, he just called you a fatso and said your wife's a gold digger. You should punch him in the face. It's like, what the fuck? But that's where it's good, because you want that and they don't give it to you. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Again, it speaks to the level of unease where I feel like in a mainstream film, there'd be that moment, you know, that crowd pleasing moment where he cocks back and punches him in the nose and you're waiting for that. And there's even a moment close to the third act where it feels like that moment's coming, where it feels like that confrontation is happening. And they have one, and then they just kind of go their separate ways, and you feel, you do feel tense, weirdly watching this, because it continually subverts your expectations, I feel like, in a good way.
Brilliantly menacing, I think, is the best way to describe it. Yeah. Very menacing movie.
If it does win, deserving. I think it is deserving of it. Would it be my pick? No. I do think it's one of the better movies I saw this year. And again, just fucking great acting all around. That's Power of the Dog. We enjoy that. And I think it's, again, I think, Chris, you said it too, for your example, it's a movie that you'll personally appreciate. the more you think about it. That's been kind of the case for me. The more I kind of read up on it, I like kind of diving into the little bits at the end, especially with the Bible verse and stuff. I think that added kind of more to the, like, the lore of what they were trying to create there with the Peter character. So that's Power of the Dog. Let's talk about Belfast and Spencer. Let's start with Belfast first. We won't hang on these quite as long, but Belfast, this was released a couple weeks ago. This is actually, you can rent this now on YouTube, wherever, or Apple TV, wherever you rent stuff, movies. So you can rent it now officially, but stars a couple of people that you may recognize. Dame Judi Dench. By the way, Jane Campion is a dame. Dame Jane Campion. I should have known.
Yes.
I say I always will do that, so I need to do that. Jamie Dornan, who is, we're going to talk about Kristen Stewart in a second. Speaking of people who have got out from underneath the thumb of garbage franchises, Jamie Dornan in the lead male role in this. An actress from, I don't know if I say her name right, Catriona Balfe, an Irish actress. Is in the lead role of the main female, but it's Jude Hill is this, this young kid, which I don't even know how old is he. 10, is he 9, 10 years old, like the actual actor, but he plays this kid Buddy, who is, it's based largely on Kenneth Branagh's life. It's a semi autobiographical movie, which chronicles, the life of a working class Northern Irish family and their young son's childhood during the troubles in Belfast, Northern Ireland from, August 15, 1969 to early 1970. The movie is mostly in black and white. It diverts from that, and I think one of the cooler stylistic choices of the year in any movie I saw. This is just cool to see. I like Kenneth Branagh. Kenneth Branagh has made some pretty bad fucking movies recently.
Remember that Shakespeare one? We shit on that so bad. That was such a piece of shit.
There's just no real way around it. Artemis Fowl in 2020. Artemis Fowl was heinous.
My worst movie of last year.
Dame Judi Dench.
Yeah.
Thank God that Judi Dench, Dame Judi Dench, and Kenneth Branagh came back for something better than Artemis Fowl was
heinous. Almost
unbelievable.
It's one of the worst Disney movies ever, period. I mean, it was horrifying.
It's a weird movie almost to compare to this in a sense, because that movie, shit child actor, and Dame Judi Dench and Kenneth Branagh, and this one did all the things opposite of that. It's so funny. There's a weird point of comparison.
It makes me wonder if Kenneth Branagh told Judi Dench at some point, look, I'm making this piece of shit Disney movie. Be in this, and I'll let you be in Belfast. Because I remember watching, she was in a 6-month span, was in Cats and Artemis Fowl. And it's like, man, if she didn't have fucking tenure, her career would be over. Mm-hmm. Like, she's embarrassing herself in these.
She was in the Shakespeare movie, All Is True.
Yeah, wow.
Where Kenneth Branagh does play William Shakespeare.
With that
movie
cap.
I didn't like that movie. But that movie wasn't like truly as horrible as Artemis Fowl, which is tough to say anything is.
Yeah.
But before that, Murder on the Orient Express, which was a pretty big letdown given the cast. Cinderella, which I actually think has aged well, the Lily James Cinderella movie. Before that, Jack Ryan, Shadow Recruit, Thor. I mean,
yeah.
It's, I like the first Thor, actually.
No, we'll talk about
Thor in a second.
We'll talk about Thor in a second, because Thor is referenced in this movie. So he's had a run of some pretty tough movies. This is a fantastic movie, and I've actually liked it more than I initially saw it. I didn't bump my score up that much, but I gave it a 92 out of 100. I think this is such a, it's almost like a weird, so it's definitely a positive kind of, there are some negative things that go on here, right, in this kind of semi-autobiographical tale, but it definitely is a more kind of positive semi-autobiographical type thing in that sense, right? Like, it's not overtly terrible. Like, cheery is not the right word. I'm trying to think of the right word to describe it.
Charming,
I think, might be the right word. It's definitely charming. But in that same sense, there's kind of like a cool genre bending feel to it, right? At times, I think it's shot wonderfully. It's one of the best looking movies of the year, easily. Just the cinematography choices in this movie are excellent. The way this movie looks in some of the close-up shots, some of the more tense scenes, it's awesome. And then, like I mentioned already, the only time you see this movie in color is when they go to see a stage plays. Like when they see this like theatrical performance and you see it in color. And that's like, I guess, you know, the imaginative wonder of this character based on Kenneth Branagh, where he kind of dips into a different world. I think that is awesome. It was easily one of the best stylistic choices of any movie of, and I even went up there with Dune 2021, just a really cool way of telling that story. I have a hard time kind of describing like the genre bending thing. So I'll kind of let you take it over. Also acting, Jamie Dornan's a fucking awesome actor, by the way.
Yeah.
I love Jamie Dornan, but I don't know, Kendrick, if you agree with that, but like, it feels like almost a mix of it's a coming of age type story, but it's like kind of a mix of genres in a way. It's interesting in that sense.
For sure. I end up landing on a 95 out of 100 for this movie. I really enjoyed it. It's one of my favorites of the year. And I think that the movie, and you queued me up for this well before. I think that the movie that defines the word that describes this movie the best is just charm, because it's a super, super charming movie. Very naturally charming, too. Like, you could tell in a movie when they try to like manufacture it. And it felt very organic. And I think they presented it as like, and I think the genre is like you're trying to describe. It's like, it's slice of life for sure. And it's like a little bit of slice of life, a little bit of like more dramatic, I would say, overtones, a little bit of darker overtones, like the political, social, religious tones, or rather setting of it all. And that part of it, I think, is a big strength for the movie, and also at points a little bit of a weakness, which I can get to as well. But I think that I was really shocked more than anything else that this movie was fantastic from just an acting perspective. And it reminded me more than anything that Jamie Dornan has the potential to be a really incredible actor outside of the 50 Shades world, because he was so tanked by that movie, and everything I've seen him in since then, that was that Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar. He was so funny in that, so charming. He's in that movie, that really, really bad movie with Emily Blunt that was in Ireland. I forget the name of it, but he was good in that. And he's just so good. Especially, yes. And when he's paired with someone who he has great chemistry with, like, I believe it's Katrina Balfe. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right either. But I think when he's paired with someone like that, he has good chemistry with, he's fantastic. And I think both of them had really, really like marquee scenes in this movie. Like the scene where she makes Buddy return to whatever it was through the middle of the rides, I thought was excellent. The scene where he serenades her, like amazing. And also the rest of the family unit, Kieran Hines crushed it. He was so, so good in this movie, and I love him in everything. But Dame Judi Dench again, and really, really good in this. And I think that their dynamic as like a full three generational family unit it really blew me away. Jude Hill, we talk about it all the time. A bad kid actor can derail a movie, especially when the movie is focused around them. You see that in a movie like Artemis Fowl. Jude Hill is phenomenal. He was so, so, so good in this movie. And he added to that natural charm of this. And I think that this is my favorite movie from Branagh, at least from a visual standpoint. Because like you're saying, Jeff, it's just a fucking gorgeous movie. Like, I can't, like, it's very hard to take your eyes off of it, because every shot is very, it's just like, I don't want to say like Wes Anderson-y, but it's very, everything's framed very well. Like every single individual shot's framed great. That color scene was insanely good. I think the only point I can take off, or only place in the movie or area I can take off points with, is really just like the focus. And that's to say, like, I think it tries to like do a lot. Like it does that slice of life, the family unit, it does the religious persecution, does the social lessons, and does like all that stuff. And I think a little bit more focus on one element would have taken it out of what is like the A tier to me into the S tier. And that would have been my biggest point of and maybe emphasis on like, or critical, or more place that I'm like a little bit disappointed in the movie more than anything else, which is very little. But other than that, really, really enjoyed this a lot. I do love when someone says, or they make a movie and it's a semi-autobiographical or whatever, and like his family happens to be the only good people in the entirety of Belfast. It's like I'm sure like, you would have added a little bit more fun.
Right, yeah. That's what some people
that's a really good point. Yeah,
yeah.
People criticize, they're like, it's a little too, I think I read one review said like glossy-eyed, like it's a little too much of that. But
Yeah, that's the only thing. But like, I think that's part of what makes the movie a little more charming. But like, that's where I think I'm sure a lot of more of the critical heads will get pissy. It's like they, I'm sure they want more grittiness to it, a little bit more like, so maybe someone in the family unit is a little bit more they're Protestant, so like hate Catholics or whatever. But like, they were very, very like the literally the only good people in the movie. So that would, a little grittiness stuff would have helped. But I don't think that, I'm not sure if that clashed against the sort of inherent nature of the movie, which was to be a little bit more charming and lighthearted, at least throughout most of the time. So reminded me a bit of, and I don't want to say a direct comparison, but reminded me of Jojo Rabbit in a sense.
Oh yeah,
in that way. I'm sure you said. Oh yeah. So Chris, yeah, no, I'm sure you love the you go off on that.
I do. Yeah, I want to note again, Jude Hill, and you can expand on this too, Chris. Jude Hill being good in this was, I mean, so young. That was the reason the movie worked more than anything. Mm-hmm. Not saying he was the only good part, but like. Like if the kid doesn't work, this movie is a stinker.
Boned. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I got it at a 77 out of 100. With that said, it's in my top five of the year right now. I think it's very, very good. Incredibly sincere, you know, for directorially. And I think, you know, we were joking about it earlier. You know, Artemis Fowl was terrible. I don't put the failures of that movie necessarily on Kenneth Branagh. When you look at that movie, was in production hell for almost 20 years. And when that happens and the waters get diluted, bad movies get made. And really the only good moments of that film, there is some neat shot composition. Like I think very talented director. I like this movie quite a bit. I think it's, you know, very honest. It's what a film really should be, which is something that feels like it has something to say. You mentioned Sirian Hynes.
Kieran, the way that's spelled is Kieran. Yeah. The way it's just the Irish version of spelling of Kieran.
Thank you. Okay.
Name Kieran.
Kieran Hynes. I would say right now, front runner for best supporting. Again, it's, I've been around the Oscars long enough to know that that's something they love. Aging character actor who's been around forever, who gives one of the best performances of his career. You know, like Christopher Plummer for Beginners that one year. I mean, I could see them having something similar with Kieran Hynes this year. And not to mention, he's brilliant in it. Him and Judi Dench together are wonderful. You guys brought up Jamie Dornan. Wanted to focus on him for a second because there's more than this, but there's three big film franchises that I don't blame any of the actors for their performances. It's the Star Wars prequels, Twilight, and 50 Shades of Grey. So I've only seen maybe half of the first one and it's bad, right? But I got so mad when those movies came out and they were like, well, Dakota Johnson's okay, but this guy playing Christian Grey stinks. Well, how about we let him be in a real movie first and then we'll decide if he can actually act. He's just charisma, you know, extremely high watching this. I mean, he's very, very likable, but it's clear he has a dramatic chops as well. You know, it's so unfortunate when you get a role that like propels your career, but also kind of stunts your career, which is what those 50 Shades movies were, where yes, he became mainstream, but people were also like, I think this guy stinks. He's really, really great in this. You guys brought up the kid. I'll say this, and he is good in it. He's good. And like you said, the movie probably would have been foobarred without him. You mentioned Jojo Rabbit, Ken Jack. I was going to make that comparison. Jojo Rabbit is one of my favorite movies the last several years. Adore that movie. I think the kid in this, he's good. But I thought back to Jojo Rabbit where Roman Griffin Davis is so excellent in that as Jojo. I don't think he quite reaches those heights, but he does do a very good job. The one big two complaints I have. One, the movie, it is very simple. I mean, the basic premise of the film is there's riots in Belfast. Are they going to leave Belfast? And then by the end of the movie, you find out whether or not they're going to. Now, of course, there is even a charm to that. And the movie is self-aware, I feel like, with its simplicity. The one complaint I have is that the main character, Jude Hill's character, to me was the least interesting in the film. I thought the parents and the grandparents, their dynamic, I found more intriguing and more interesting. That's a minor complaint because even that you could argue like, well, it's told through his perspective. And yes, things, when you see your parents and you see everything going on around you, life feels a lot bigger than it is. And you may feel a little bit insignificant when you have these crazy events going on. So I think it's a really well done movie. It's very honest, very heartfelt. I think unlike Power of the Dog, I bet a lot of mainstream audiences are going to go to this and really enjoy it and get a kick out of it and you know, be have their heart kind of warm to it. So I think it's a very good movie. I would be stunned if it doesn't get nominated for a ton of awards. And I would say Kieran Hines has a legitimate shot at best supporting.
Yeah. You kind of wish this was Netflix.
Right? Yeah,
I agree.
See, it's kind of interesting you say that with the kid actor focus. I think that the best movies kind of find a way to do that. You know what I mean? Like, if you think of a movie where you have a focus on a kid actor, I think one that comes to mind is like Willy Wonka, for example. Right. Like, kid actor, big focus on there, but they don't make him the focus point to, and like, they let him sort of be the vehicle so that you can, you know, sort of drive the audience to watch better adult performances, because like, they're legit professionals that have been doing this forever versus a kid who is still like learning the ropes. And I do think that that is kind of the mark of the good usage of a kid actor, when you let them, you know, play to their strengths, limit the amount of damage they can do versus try and excel the amount that they can do from a positive standpoint.
Yeah. I guess there's one big, he has one big blow up scene in the movie, and you guys know what I'm talking about, but, and I thought that was, it was good. It was fine. I was just waiting for that big kind of like, there's that moment. And maybe it's unfair because tonally these movies are completely different, but I think back to Jojo Rabbit, which has two or three scenes that completely break your heart. And the kid actor, you know, Roman Griffin Davis completely sold him. I was waiting for that moment in this movie, that moment where, you know, the tears started to flow, and it doesn't, that moment never really came for me, but that by no means makes it a bad film. There's also one other minor complaint is the movie at many points has a few tonal shifts that I found a little bit jarring. There's a few kind of scenes that are very heavily comedic leaning. And I wasn't crazy about those. I thought the movie worked best when you were dealing with the family drama, dealing with the more dramatic elements of the movie. I feel like the film's at its best and at its most focused during those scenes.
Yeah, I agree.
Pretty damn good movie though. I think we can agree on. And definitely worthy of kind of the hype it's got. I just hope people can see it. It's rentable now. It's an expensive rent. It's either this or Spencer is $19.99 rent, and then one's $24. Regardless, it's not a cheap rent. You know, it's not like a $3.99 rental, so it's going to the movies basically. But you can check out Belfast now. Definitely one of the better movies of the year. I think very justifiable in its praise for being up for Best Picture. And then lastly, let's talk quickly here about Spencer. If you don't know what Spencer is, we'll read you the synopsis real quick. The marriage between Princess Diana and Prince Charles has long since grown cold. Through rumors of affairs and a divorce abound, peace is ordained for the Christmas festivities at the Queen's estate. There's eating and drinking, shooting, hunting, all that. Diana knows the game, but this year things will be profoundly different. It's like royal family get out.
yeah, it's a good way to put it.
It is. I think there are some flaws with this movie. There are definitely some faults with this movie. However, I think two things are huge. I think in terms of a biopic, wonderfully crafted. In terms of telling the story, I think if you're going to do a story like this about somebody so recognizable, about a story that most people know. Like this is not the first Princess Diana thing. That's the other thing too. This is just not the first time they've done like this type of movie. There was Lady Diana that came out. That was, what year was Lady Diana with Naomi Watts?
What was that? The Naomi Watts one?
Yeah. Naomi Watts.
13 or 14.
Yeah. Yeah. Like that goes down to like, that goes all the way up to like the end of her life. So like that's the, obviously the obvious way of doing that movie. This is not, and I think this is the strength of the movie, because it's like Steve Jobs. It's also like a Steve Jobs type thing too, right? I actually don't love, my biggest issue with this movie is I think everything kind of outside of Kristen Stewart's character, I think the story's great. I wish this movie had a much bigger punch. I actually, you know, I kept thinking I wish Aaron Sorkin wrote this movie.
Yeah, true.
Like, I don't think it was like,
I can totally, I see that completely. Yeah,
I really liked it. Like, I think Kenjack, I know you and I enjoyed it. I'll hear what you say, Chris. I gave it an 86. I am always fascinated by royal stuff. I think that may play into it a little bit, but I think there could have been, I think this movie needed like a very strong and even long and drawn out. Like I think it could have been, there could have been more to it. Right. I think there could have been more of a punch to it. And I think everything Kristen Stewart does is fucking incredible, but I think this movie deserved kind of like the Steve Jobs treatment. And by that, I mean, just like someone like an Aaron Sorkin writing this movie that is dialogue heavy. That is that really drives home kind of let Lady Di at the time, her kind of, even just like talking about like relationship with her kids and like what her kids are doing like during these couple days, and just the way you see kind of a peek into her life, at least through this story, and about how she was dealing with like the idea of royalty and the idea of her marriage and everything. I think this movie could have benefited greatly from, it's funny to say this, being longer and packing a little more of a weighty punch to it, just around or beyond just the fact that Kristen Stewart, what she worked with here was incredible. She did such a fucking good job, and she is, I think, the best actress of the year. But that's where I land my initial thoughts with Spencer. Ken Jack.
Yeah, I really I enjoyed a lot about this movie. Ended up landing on an 87. I do like the comparison of like Royal Get Out, because I think that's kind of like the idea of it, right? It's like you're kind of like trapped in this little like very closed, intimate quarters and everything, and like how you deal with that. I do think the one thing that we were really afraid of going into it, right, or at least that I was afraid of, was like, how are they going to pitch this movie about like, as far as Princess Di's relation to the press and society? I think they did a good job. Like the way that they end up like balancing the focus of like her trouble, I think was really good, because they humanized her a lot, like Princess Di, because I think as far as the press is concerned, and I think a lot of our public consumption of her persona and all that, it was very like romanticized at points, dramatized at points. Like this just made her look like a regular human being, which she was. And I think that was the biggest success of this movie. Definitely a little bit, I guess the right word would be like melodramatic at points, like a little like soap opera-y at sometimes, but it would have done for a little bit more down-to-earth and grittiness as outside of just the character of Princess Di. I think that Kristen Stewart, I would agree, I think she's best actress of the year after this role. It's insane how great these actresses and actors can do when they're outside of these shitty franchises. I really enjoyed her. It's weird, because like this movie's good. It's not, I don't have like a ton to say about it, other than like I enjoyed it a lot. I don't think a movie that I would go out of my way to ever rewatch again, but I think that there's a lot to really love about this, and I think that the primary reason to watch it more than anything else is just to see the performance from Kristen Stewart, because she blew it out of the water.
I have it at, go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah. No, I was going to say, like, I think I'm just like, just to reinforce what I was saying, I think my biggest thing is that it's a movie where it's a story choice or a narrative choice in how you're going to structure this biopic, where you're picking it over a couple days and you could only have it so much happen. And in order for that to kind of pack that punch and to drive home and deliver something very meaningful, impactful, you have to have a tour de force in writing and a tour de force in the way that a dialogue. And I think that is unfortunately where it lacks. That's why Jobs works so well. Excuse me, not Jobs, Steve Jobs. That's why that movie, at least for me, works so well, is because what Aaron Sorkin wrote for that movie, and those were fictionalized events. You know, Aaron Sorkin said it. He's like, look, not every single big product launch of Steve Jobs' life had a conflict with the five most important people at Apple. But he goes, but you know, you look, I mean, Aaron Sorkin's been, and that's why I love Aaron Sorkin, respect him, is he really has no qualms about, I guess, bending the truth a little bit to still tell his story. And if you listen, you could listen him further about it. He's been questioned about it. He has some good answers on it. And I'm not saying they should have done that here. And I'm sure they did take some liberties, but you really like it's, again, I think it's really good. And I think the acting is what really brings it up. Also looks great too. I love the look of the movie. One of my favorite viewers on YouTube, Chris Stuckman, even pointed out, and I noticed this too, is like hair and makeup, everything. And they're like, it looks great. But man, I think this truly, my only disappointing thing, not to be too negative, movie I liked, like I think this could have been, with the right script, like really, really fucking good, and kind of beyond that, because Princess Diana is such still a relevant person and the royals are still so relevant that, man, this could have really made waves this year. That's my only like real kind of bummer with how I felt about it in the end. But yeah, go ahead, Chris. Yes. What were your thoughts?
There's two things in this movie that are great. One, you guys have brought it up and everybody's going to. I would say the biggest Oscars lock this year is Kristen Stewart for Best Actress. Not just getting nominated, but winning it. I don't see anybody else knocking her off. She gives an incredible performance. It's a subtle performance, but she does an amazing job. I think Frances McDormand is another example of an actress who does this brilliantly. There's just a pain in her face in the entire movie. I mean, the entire time it looks like she's about to cry or on the verge of breaking down. And it's an amazing, amazing performance. She gets the accent down, you know, just the way she kind of, there's a lack of confidence in herself. And you can see that she's kind of looking at the ground when she speaks. I mean, it's a very heartbreaking, emotional, but not overly emotional performance too. And this is where we kind of have an interesting dynamic here. I think everything about the royal family is uninteresting. They do nothing for me. I never have. I'd find them just, and if people enjoy it, that's fine. I find them just so boring. Now, one thing I actually love about this movie is the film kind of acknowledges that Princess Diana just like, I want to just wear a dress. And like, well, you can't do that because we have traditions and we have these things that have been established for hundreds upon hundreds of years. And I found there's like a meta element to it that I thought was really intriguing and interesting. I'm with you that it's the script itself. It's not bad. Like the dialogue is fine, but it lacks the emotional punch that you would want out of something like, you know, Steve Jobs, the prime example. I love that movie. Like, I think we got Steve Jobs out as a society. And when that movie came out, so, you know, it got nominated for stuff, but people kind of ignore it. I thought it was brilliant. And that's another, you know, that's a phenomenal biopic here. Yeah, you're right. You get to the end and similar to Belfast, but even I would say worse, you kind of look at it and you go, okay, well, what was that all for? For somebody who clearly was going through such a difficult time in her own life, it feels like you get to the end. And while there is an arc, it feels like there should be something more. Like that, if you would have done one more draft of the script and really kind of elevated some of that material, you could have had one of the better movies of the year. Like you said, the movie looks great. There's, in a much different way, but similar to Power of the Dog, there is an element of unease throughout the entire, like the, it feels like with the cinematography, there's a kind of a lot of like, you know, fish angle lens kind of just shots. And it feels, you get that feeling that I'm sure they were going for, which is this idea that Princess Diana felt like this small fish in a really, really huge pond. And it captures the kind of scope of the royal family. I have it at a 71. I just because I could never see myself watching it again. I do feel like because it lacks kind of its emotional punch. And also, okay, this is one legitimate complaint. There's a very bizarre, it's not subplot, but this whole thing of like her seeing ghosts, like I'm not even really exact, like that's like an element to this movie with maybe there's a history behind that. But there's a very weird tangent the movie makes at several points of like her talking to the ghost of Anne Boleyn. And I know there's, you know, there's maybe real life parallels. I understand that, but I thought that was executed very strangely. I think the movie works. It's at its absolute best when the focus is on Princess Diana's own personal struggles and her mental health. And that was a weird moment for a movie that has a lot of subtlety to it. There's this weird kind of tangent that it takes where it feels like it goes way above and beyond and trying to hammer home the fact that she was not well. I thought that was a bit bizarre, but all in all, it's a good movie. It's going to get nominated for a ton of awards, but probably not one I would ever go out of my way to watch again.
Yeah. I think it's going to be an award darling for costume, for look of the movie, cinematography, probably, but especially for acting with Kristen Stewart. Ken Jack, you've seen Being the Ricardo, speaking of Aaron Sorkin, I know people love Nicole Kidman, which I'm rooting for mostly again, because no offense to Deborah Messing, but I'm just tired of people saying Deborah Messing should have, like, why? Because she has red hair? Like,
because she has red hair and kind of resembles Lucille Ball.
She like, dressed up as Lucille Ball actor. Once for Halloween. Like, again, I like Deborah Messing.
Actor actress to do it. Jesus.
Legendary actress, Deborah Messing. Legendary sitcom actor. Like, yeah.
Okay, legendary was even pushing it. Like Nicole Kidman is legendary. Like, Deborah Messing exists. Like, it's like they're very different tiers of actresses.
Can I just, real quick, there's one thing I wanted to bring up. Another minor thing I had about Spencer that bothered me. Is it, I don't know why I'm you. It just makes sense using this movie as a template, but one great thing about Steve Jobs that the other Steve Jobs movie, the Ashton Kutcher one, kind of lacked, is the main character really had other good personalities to bounce off of. Kate Winslet's great in that. Seth Rogen, that's like one of his best roles ever. Jeff Daniels is excellent. There's nobody else. I feel like everybody else outside of Princess Diana in this is written really flatly. And it just doesn't seem like there's ever like any big, you know, good actors, right? And there is a neat little moment in the third act with Sally Hawkins. But I feel like if you really want to make a good biopic, sometimes it's more important to get the supporting characters right than it is to get the main actors right. And it's so Kristen Stewart's movie that it feels like everybody else is just kind of there for a large majority of the movie. And I think it speaks to the point you guys brought up that the script itself is just okay.
Mm-hmm. I just got Marvel news. We'll talk about it in a second. It's the one thing. It's like, people give a shit all the time. We talk so negative about movies that we like, but that's one thing I was like, man, I like that. Then I was like, damn, that could have been great. that could have really been like truly great. But there's reasons why I liked it. And credit to anyone who tries to do something different with the biopic and like doesn't just do like what they already did with Lady Di and what they already did with like the Naomi Watts story. So credit there. Next up, Will Forte interview. We talked to Will Forte about a bunch of things, MacGruber as well. Tim and Eric, here's an interview with Will Forte. All right, we are very excited to be joined by one of our favorites, Will Forte. Thanks for joining us. How are you? How's everything going?
Everything's great. I'm doing well. I'm doing a have you heard of the Prolon diet?
No.
My wife and I are doing it together. It was like a post Thanksgiving attempt to shed some stuffing weight, and it's like a 5-day thing. Well, it's more than just losing weight. It's like it's supposed to be very good for your cellular health.
Okay.
So we're day 4 of 5 where you're eating whatever they give you, which is basically little powder packets of soup stuff. You add water and it's actually kind of a fun challenge, and I'm not trying to do an ad for
the pre-New Year's diet is bold. That's a bold mm-hmm. move.
Oh yeah. I just wanted to explain there may be some, I'm a little spacey in the best of times, but these conditions are potential, like, very spacey.
Yeah.
But,
I've said some weird, I've been on an all soup diet before and I've said some weird stuff.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. That's all like, he's on an all soup diet. I can tell.
Our buddy who put us towards this once he had us do an all water diet for 3 days. So this one's 5 days, but you get to eat little bits of food here and there. The water thing's just, it's all water. It's nuts for 3 days.
That's just being on the show Survivor. That's all that
yeah.
is.
Mm-hmm. No, exactly. Okay, I'm going to stop talking about diet stuff.
So, we get 30 minutes of just diet. No, but you have new project, Middle Space, Audible Original, premiered November 18th. We've done a couple interviews on these Audible Original type projects, and they are always so fun to talk about because casts are crazy. It's such a different type of thing from typically most of what the people we talk to, including yourself, can do. Because this is not, you know, it's not something that I feel like that type of content that I consumed even just a couple years ago, but it feels like it's such a wide ranging thing. There's always so many big names involved. What can you tell people about Middle Space?
Oh, I tell you what, it was the most delightful. Paul Lieberstein is just so funny. I've been a fan of The Office forever, and my wife is, I mean, as big a fan of The Office as I am, she's a crazy Office fanatic. Like, she's probably watched the series. I don't think it'd be unrealistic to say that she had watched the whole thing through 100 times. Like, she just has it in the background of everything she's doing all the time. So it was, already I was very interested when I heard about this thing. And then when you read it, it's so fun to read. The character that I play is just such a fun, it was so fun to do. And we recorded it. It just took like a week to record. We did really long days each day, which they were saying in the beginning, you should probably do shorter days. Just do a longer period of time, but shorter days. But I think I was up against this trip to New Zealand I had to take to do this show Sweet Tooth. And so I said, no, let's try to get it. Let's just get it out of the way. And I'll tell you, these long days just flew by. It was so much fun doing this. He's such a great writer. It's just bonkers. It's so fun. It like ping pongs all over the place. It's just a very unique bit of writing and characters I haven't actually heard the whole thing put together yet. So I'm very excited to hear how it turned out because the cast is amazing too.
We asked this a lot about people who do voice roles, and obviously you've done a ton of other voice roles as well. How do you sort of get in the zone without being able to feed off your castmates, like physical, comedic, or like kinetic energy, so to speak?
Oh, wow. Well, there was this, and I am blanking on his name now, but there was a guy that they had in there who was just awesome, and he would read everything with me. So he was fantastic. Oh, I feel like such a jerk. It must have been coming up on a year ago that we, or maybe more than a year ago that we actually recorded it. So, but there's still no excuse. I should remember his name, but he was invaluable during the recording process because he would just be, given his all for the entire recording process as these other characters. So that made it much easier. But it was also then fun to think about, the different energy that it would take on once the other people were added into the mix. Yeah.
What about even just, I think in general, like your comedy and from the things that I know of that you've done over the years, no matter what the shows are, you especially like facial expressions and physical comedy, when you do voice roles, like do you have to kind of rework the way you deliver lines because you're not showing off, whether you're yelling, you are an all-time comedic yeller, yeah. I feel like as a big Tim and Eric fan, especially like I can see you yelling, but in a voice role, you don't have that luggage. There's a different way you have to approach that so they can almost hear that physical, like facial expression.
Thank you very much. I take great pride in my yelling, my yell work. It does take a while to really understand the differences between regular acting stuff and voice stuff and way back, the very first acting job I had was a voiceover job on, I was Abe Lincoln on Clone High. So, especially then it was tough to do because I had yet to be on any kind of television show, I didn't even know what it was like to do non-voice acting stuff. So there's a huge difference between theater stuff, which was what my main experience was at that point, and TV stuff. So I was like all over the map. But yeah, it takes a while. You realize, oh yeah, people don't get to see what my face looks like. So you just figure out, it takes a while, but you figure out how to learn to get emotions across through your voice. And obviously with animated shows, there are some expressions that they'll put in there, so it's not nothing that they're working with, but for this, it's just people are listening. So you gotta make sure to try to put a little extra zing on everything.
Exactly. Middle space.
I mean, by the way, he did it. The writing is so good that, I could have basically just phoned it in and it would be amazing.
I feel don't sell yourself short on that. So, you know, add a little flavor. Middle Space out, Audible original. You have another project coming up, which is kind of crazy to say that this is happening.
Oh yeah,
MacGruber, and I feel like the big update on that. What's the update on Christopher Nolan's involvement did Jorma get any more extra, a little Easter egg from him? Because I feel like that was one of those things that popped up. I was like, wait a second, Christopher Nolan's a MacGruber super fan. Do we have any update on that? I know he's invited to a table read.
This is all Jorma's thing, because we John and I, who are the other two thirds of the MacGruber trio, we just want Christopher Nolan to live a happy life from us, and Jorma's just keep getting out there. But you know, who knows? Maybe he'll wear him down, and Christopher will at one point come and help us out in some way.
Are you mad? That's what he asked, though. He asked to like come to a table read and not like, hey, maybe we be in your movie. Like, can we be in Tenet? Can we be in, you know? Like, I feel like he may have blew the opportunity.
Yeah,
he's always asking him to come and be a part of stuff. We were trying to see if there was a possibility, and obviously you'd need to do this with his blessing. But to say that something was directed by Christopher Nolan with an asterisk by it, and then say really directed by Jorma or something like that. But I think guild rules are pretty strict. And so I don't think we even went to the, we didn't even get to the step of asking Christopher Nolan, because
getting him kicked out of the guild would not be the best move.
You know, I think the good alternative is for you to somehow get cast into the new Oppenheimer movie, because now the more I look at you, you could play Harry Truman. I could see it. It would work.
Oh, is that what his latest movie is?
It's going to be an Oppenheimer movie.
Oh, yeah. Wow. That'll be cool.
I know. I can't wait for that. But yeah, we'll work on getting you cast in that. What can you tell us about, by the way, just in general, the MacGruber series and just MacGruber 2?
So the MacGruber series is basically taking the place of MacGruber 2. Not that we would never consider doing another movie. You know, we love MacGruber and you know, would probably seize on the opportunity to do it in any form and keep moving forward with it. But the series takes off about 10 years after the movie. It takes up rather 10 years after the movie. So if we ever did any kind of movie, it would be, you know, continuing off of where MacGruber is presently at.
Gotcha. But
the series is what, you know, it's an 8-episode series. We're really excited by how it turned out. I think that people who liked the movie, I think, will probably like it. Peacock let us do whatever we wanted to do.
Nice. It's
very emotionally overwrought, like the movie, and it's very violent and pretty dirty. There's a lot of swearing, but it's just a lot of fun. It's very much the same tone as the movie, and we're excited for people to see it. Comes out soon, like December 16th.
Yeah, very soon.
Mm-hmm. We can't wait. We're gonna have to fix it, by the way. In IMDb, it says that MacGruber 2 is in pre-production. I was just like, I didn't even fucking know that.
Oh yeah, for some reason that has been on there forever, but. I mean, in a way, they're right. We've been trying to make a MacGruber 2 movie since like a week after the movie came out and bombed in theaters. We're like, let's do a second one. We'll show them.
The actual character, right, took a little bit of convincing from Jorma to get you to get on board, right? What kind of changed your mind on the character?
Well, it was we were at SNL at the time, and he had kept approaching John Solomon and I about writing. We would always just get together to write stuff every week or two. And he kept pitching this MacGruber idea, and we thought it, I don't know, it just didn't strike our fancy, I guess. And eventually, I think just to kind of get him to shut up, we said, we'll write your MacGruber thing. And of course, I'm really happy we listened to him. And I think that at first we I think we had been talking about it as a sketch, which wasn't working in our brains. And then once we kind of committed to writing it, and then we stumbled on the short film, the series of the triple short film. How do you say that? The three segments.
And yes, I don't know what to say. Yeah,
that's the technical term, right? Once we stumbled onto that, it made sense in our brains and then became a lot of fun. But yeah, thank God he was persistent.
Even so, like that, you've done, you know, Last Man on Earth, good example of a show that people love, people enjoy. That's like, this is not like new territory for you, obviously, at all. But even like recently streaming shows, and that's kind of the nice thing about this is going on streaming. Go look at, you know, for example, Ted Lasso, someone who even in Last Man on Earth, like take a look, like these shows have taken on such a different life, and especially kind of now MacGruber's probably a different upbeat than Ted Lasso. I will say that, but it's still, it's like, it's a funny comedic upbeat, and comedies now especially are just thriving on these types of platforms. That has to add even a whole different bit of excitement, especially compared to, you know, like one of the previous shows you did, like a Last Man on Earth, that was kind of in the normal like network TV Sunday nights, and now this MacGruber is going to be experienced in that streaming sense.
Oh yeah, no, it's very exciting, and it, you know, Last Man on Earth, we were on Hulu also, but it seems like the even then, I don't think that, and I'm older, so I it's very possible that people were streaming a tremendous amount back then. But, you know, I think it was Last Man on Earth came out either 2014 or 2015. And it was still just, you know, there was Netflix, obviously, and Hulu, and then Amazon Prime was, I don't know when they started, but it definitely now it's everything is streaming. I haven't watched, I do still watch network TV sometimes, but it's usually from their streaming apps.
Right.
You don't even have a traditional TV. We just got a monitor for, or, you know, one of those Roku TVs. Mm-hmm. Or is that, I don't know, is that considered a?
Yeah.
My wife is my tech person too. So
I'm one of the few cable
guys here has some problems with technology.
We would love to talk to you about SNL as well, just in general, because we're huge fans of like just your specific run in SNL, because it hit us right in when we were at the specific age. And we'd always joke about this with SNL people, just like how every single person says their generation of SNL was the best. You know what I mean? Like, you probably think that like that generation that you grew up watching is the best. We think that your generation was the best. It's just how it seems to work out. But we loved yours. And my specific favorite is always the motivational coach skit with Peyton Manning. Because
thank you.
So goddamn funny. And beyond that, the fact that everyone in the whole cast in the back is all breaking while you're doing your thing, I think, is that the best feeling as a cast member, is when you get everyone else to break?
It's fun because it's fun to know that people are having fun in a sketch. That's always, you know. I don't know. While I'm doing the sketch, you're so just locked in and trying to not mess up. And I actually didn't really even see them because I'm out there just being a dipstick, dancing the whole time. So I'm trying to figure out after the dress rehearsal of the show, I remembered, I don't know, that it was going well throughout the week, but still just something hadn't locked in. I hadn't really quite done a dance that was good enough yet. So after the dress rehearsal, Lauren had picked it to go into the show. So we saw that it was going in, but he suggested maybe shortening the dancing. And then thank God this rarely happens, at least for me, but the best version of the sketch was the one that actually made it to air. A lot of times your best version will be the dress rehearsal one.
And I've heard that before. Yeah.
These expectations and it'll be a little flatter, but this was one where just the dance seemed to be kicking in. And I just kind of went for a while, and I definitely went longer than I had in the dress rehearsal, but Man, that's I appreciate you saying that. That I think that's that would be when people ask what my favorite one is that I ever got to do. I think that's probably at the top.
I recently discovered I didn't know this about SNL. I recently watched a couple of videos. One was Bill Hader talking about a sketchy pitch called the Kasems. It was all a bunch of Casey Kasem's family, and like they all sound the same. And another was Pete Davidson talking about a skit that he did or he pitched a skit that was singing Wonderwall really badly out of his like house window or something. But they both talked about bombing at table reads and how horrible it is because. I get from what I've gathered is Lauren and everyone, they want your full 100% commitment at a table read. And there's no, once you've bombed, there's no giving up. You're doing the whole thing and you just have to keep doing it at these table reads. Do you have a story like that where a table read went so bad and you're sitting there, and you're like, fuck, I have to keep doing this. This is awful.
Oh man. All it happens all the time. I can't even think of a specific sketch, but yeah, all the time you might have like, you know, you might know on page one of a 10 page sketch that it's not going anywhere and you got to do it. Actually 10 pages is probably a little long, but you know, 6 or 7 pages and you just got to muscle through it and give it your all. And I think people, everyone in that room has been in the same boat who's sitting at the table, having been a writer or performer at SNL, that, you know, everyone's written some major clunkers and you know, everyone's very, you kind of have fun with the clunkers.
That was your Hater said too. He's like, I guess Tina Fey was next to him. And he's like, I remember her under her breath. Like, what the fuck was that?
That just made me think of a story. And this was not a clunker. This was actually a really funny sketch, but this awesome writer, Emily Spivey, who I've known since the Groundlings Theater back in, you know, 1995 or 96, but she went to write at SNL, and my third show there, John McCain hosted the show, and she had written something where McCain has to keep saying the word frittata. He was proud of his frittata that he had made. And the whole sketch is just basically about what a weird word frittata is. And I mean, it's you're not at all commenting on what a weird word frittata is, but he's just saying frittata over and over again. Well, the little wrench was that for some reason, McCain was saying it frittata. in there, and so he's has to say frittata maybe 40 or 50 times before somebody else says frittata, so he's keeps saying frittata. And yeah, I made this wonderful frittata, would you like a bite of my frittata? And then somebody else has to say, I think I remember specifically it was Horatio Sanz then has to say frittata, and you're like, oh, is he going to say it right? Or is he, and Horatio, of course, says frittata also, just to, you know, and it just went on forever. And then finally there's action line. Lauren reads all the action lines and so he had to say frittata in an action line. And dad told the person that they had the kick me sign on their back. Cause he said, he takes the frittata out of the oven, and then everyone's like, ah.
Spoiled the fun.
So funny.
Oh, my God. It's
like one of those experiences.
We're running out of time here, but I had to mention two more things. Before we started this, Ken Jack and I watched the Tim and Eric Night Live with the gingerbread record holder where you're just yelling back and forth. And it's still one of my funny. It's still one of the hardest I've ever laughed in my life.
Blood and sweat. Ginger.
Those guys, it's so fun to do stuff with them because it's like going to therapy. You just got to just get, it's like Primal Scream therapy. you feel so grounded when you get done. You're just like, you just let all this emotion out of you. Everyone should have a good scream every day or two.
And then the other thing I did want to mention, which I would love to talk to you again, and if we do, we'll talk more on it. I if your name is brought up, I'll always bring up Nebraska, a gem of 2010s movies.
Oh, an
absolute must watch if you haven't seen it. Just an absolute, I mean, all credit to Bruce Dern, but June Squibb in that movie is just
it was so amazing getting to watch them with my own eyes the whole time. I have no idea how I got a part in that movie. Like, I still pinch myself, like, because it I don't know, it just was such a special experience, and I have no idea how they let me do that. So I'm so appreciative.
Yeah, that's just one of those endless underrated 2010 movie. But Middle Space on Audible original. Go check it out. You said you're not a big laugh out loud person. You laughed out loud reading the script. That's all you got to hear there. Then, of course, we're excited for MacGruber as well. So thank you for joining. I would love to talk to you again, too.
Yes.
Oh, I am all yours. Just name it.
Maybe we'll just yell for 30 minutes. You could teach us.
Yeah, we'll do a team scream.
You know, I already have said I love to do it. It's like therapy. We could do it together.
Oh, thank you so much. And good luck with your diet, most importantly.
Yes.
I got one more. It's 1.5 days left. So I wake up tomorrow, final day. Then it's, you know.
No more soup.
Beer and nachos, here I come.
Thank you so much.
I might, to transition, I might ground that up into a soup.
Yeah, no, fine.
Its own powder, yeah. Thank you, take care, and happy holidays.
Thank you, you too.
Thank you. All right, thank you to Will Forte. That's it. We just, you see, MODOK is supposed to be, supposed to be one of the villains in Ant-Man and the Wasp Quantumania.
Yeah, I wonder how that's going to work. I still haven't watched that series, by the way. I heard very, very good things.
Interesting. So that Kang the Conqueror, there's some pretty big fucking characters in there. Ant-Man versus the Wasp. Not Ant-Man versus the Wasp. That'd be interesting, though. Ant-Man and the Wasp, the third one, seems to be pretty wild. I think that's it, though. Never got the fucking Matrix trailer.
I did not know Catherine Newton was replacing as Scott's daughter.
Cassie Lang, yeah, Catherine Newton.
Did not know that.
Which is interesting because his daughter was fairly grown up, in Avengers Endgame.
It's kind of that's crazy.
Kind of stink to be recast. But yeah, Catherine Newton, who's in everything now. That's it. Anything else?
What's the Marvel news you just got?
Oh, that was it. Yeah.
Okay. Ant-Man.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Going to be the villain. The Matrix trailer is going to drop in like 10 minutes. I already know it. I can just tell.
Yeah.
On Sunday, West Side Story though.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, my most anticipated movie of the year.
Did you listen to the soundtrack yet?
A large majority of it.
I refuse to touch it. I care about Officer Krupke, but that is the part of the movie I'm most excited for.
Yeah, to me, West Side Story is the best musical ever. Like that's I think it's the best stage show. Like in my opinion, I remember the first night, like one of the early memories of my life was watching the original West Side Story for the first time. And I don't want to spend too much time on it because I haven't seen the remake yet. But West Side, one thing about musicals is intentionally, they're very glossy, right? It's very, one thing I've always loved about West Side Story is like the stakes and the fact that some pretty fucked up shit happens in that. Right. In that show, like that's like it's very different than a lot of other like that, and I feel like Fiddler on the Roof as well are the two musicals that have like genuinely, they don't have a big happy and Les Mis don't have big ensemble happy musical numbers at the end of the movie. I mean they're kind of dour. So and Spielberg, as versatile as they come, never directed a musical before. I it's so weird. I forgot it was delayed a year. It was last year. Mm-hmm. So. I think that's this is one of the rare movies that's going to benefit from that, because I think the West Side Story should be seen in theaters. And I think that them pushing it back allowed the hype to build it. And there was no footage for it yet either. That's the big thing, is like No Time to Die had like three full trailers,
just so many trailers.
And it got delayed for a year and a half. And like, it was like, I remember you guys talked to us, like, here's the final trailer for No Time to Die. It's like the seventh one, like, okay. Yeah. Well, like, I think we've seen half this movie at this point. So, it's too bad they delayed it, but I can't wait to talk about it, man. I think it's going to be awesome.
Yeah. I'm seeing an IMAX. I'm very excited. That's it. For Ken, Jack, and Chris, we'll talk to you next time.
Have a good week at the box office, folks.